Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 9th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar, the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday. Joining us in studio, the recently anointed politics editor of Slate, Tom Skoka, will be joining us. Also on the program today, man enters a Missouri Walmart with 100 rounds of ammo and body armor just because America. Trump visits El Paso and brings nothing but disgust. Joe Biden seemingly on a tour to prove your greatest fears are true. And the wealthiest of Trump donors want to give their money to him in secret. Online magazine Quillette, duped by a hoax. Just another example of how the right is clueless about the left. And not so great at fact-checking. Trump dumps his top director of national intelligence official because he wants more of a crony. And Tucker Carlson loses a major advertiser over his white supremacy denial. New IPCC report says climate change is making our food supply completely unsustainable. Gerald Nadler says he started a legit impeachment inquiry. And the folksy story of Trump's construction company tells us why ICE will round up 700 immigrants after they complain of working conditions for the Koch brothers, while their employers face no accountability. All this and more on today's program. Folks, let me just start off. Well, first off, let me just say happy birthday to my daughter. Longtime listeners of this program will remember when she was born 14 years ago on this day. And if you are one of those people, thank you for listening for so long. Jesus. Mila has turned 14, and, you know, she's just as pleasant as she ever was. So congratulations to my daughter.
Roasted.
Brendan and Michael are out today, and we're happy to have in studio Tom Skoka, who I will introduce in a moment. Let me just also say rest in peace to someone that people probably have no idea who he is. Most people, he's not particularly well-known. A friend of mine, a guy named Mike Reynolds, a comedian, who had many years of difficult times, and not the least of which was problems with healthcare and getting stuck in debt, and it being very demoralizing for him at different points in his life. I just wanted to acknowledge him because he was with us, and now he's not, and he had a lot of pain, and I hope he is finding some measure of peace now. Let's turn to what we saw this weekend, or I should say yesterday. Donald Trump visited El Paso, and maybe it was, I guess, Wednesday. I can't recall now. Or he was going down there Wednesday, and it's just the fallout now from that visit has been nothing short of stunning. And in some ways, it dovetails with a piece that Tom wrote that I wanted to talk to him about a little bit in a bit. But here is the report. As you know, he goes to El Paso. There, and here's the report from CNN. And it just, the video from this visit, and we'll play some of it maybe later, is just stunning. It's just stunning. In some ways, it's completely unsurprising. In other ways, it's just sort of hard to see it so vividly. But here's the CNN report on his visit to El Paso, ostensibly to comfort the victims and make the community feel more safe and embraced.
Caitlin Collins, thank you. I've been talking to a hospital official at El Paso's University Medical Center, and I'm told none of the eight patients who were on hand for the president's visit wanted to meet Mr. Trump. Quote, some didn't want any visitors, the official said, before adding, and some did not want to meet the president. We've confirmed two patients who had been discharged were brought back to the hospital to meet with the president. CNN has learned one of those patients was the two-month-old baby who was shielded by his parents during the shooting. That baby has been identified as the child of Jordan and Andre Anchondo, who died protecting him. According to the hospital official, the president displayed a, quote, absence of empathy during his visit. That hospital official went on to say the president made other comments similar to his remarks about former Congressman Beto O'Rourke that left some staffers thinking Mr. Trump was not focused enough on consoling people. That hospital official went on to say about these patients who are being cared for at University Medical Center, quote, the stories and retelling of their experience at that Walmart will chill you to your core and break your heart.
So Donald Trump goes down there, and we have footage. I don't know if we pulled it, but there's footage of Donald Trump meeting the doctors, and it takes about three sentences after he says, you guys are doing great work, for him to start talking about the size of the rally he had in El Paso a couple of months ago and how small Beto O'Rourke's was. He does the exact same. Here, let's play this clip. We might as well put all these together.
The job you've done, and they're talking about it all over the world. And it's an honor to be with you. Look at this group of people. Can you believe this?
Good-looking people. You're fantastic.
I was here 3 months ago. We made a speech, and we had a what was the name of the arena? That place was packed, right?
I was front row.
Right? The judges have respected you.
I was front row.
What was the name?
I was front row.
Oh,
good. Come here, man. That was some crowd.
Thank you.
And we had twice the number outside. And then you had this crazy Beto. Beto had like 400 people in a parking lot. They said his crowd was wonderful.
Look at me.
But we had some.
Oh, look at that.
Whoa. Oh, wow. Look at that. Look at that, Judge. You see that?
I was encouraging her. She
don't tell it to the press because they won't even believe it.
No. They only
believe. Yeah, this is, they're having, it's quite a jocular time. It's wow. Always fun, a lot of giggles. He does the exact same thing. He meets some police officers. It takes him even less time to go into how big his crowd was and how small Beto's was. I mean, this is a severely disturbed human being. And here is a picture of him with that child, the two-month-old baby that they had brought back to the hospital so that he could do a pose with the baby. There's Melania holding the baby, smiling. There's Donald Trump. Thumbs up. Look, here's the baby. Who could possibly function this way? It's just unbelievable. He's standing next to a child whose both of their parents have died in a horribly violent shooting.
This is probably the best thing that ever happened to you, huh, kid?
You're right. I'm going to sign this picture for you. Remember this forever. Unbelievable. This is going to be the tone of the show today, incidentally. This show is going to be fully demonetized and just like it's going to be ugly. All right. Now, I'd like to welcome to the programs Tom Skoka. Tom, welcome. Will you just push your microphone just down a little bit like
that?
Yeah.
Is that good?
Yeah. You can.
Okay.
You can.
All right.
Tom is the new political editor over at Slate, Slate.com, I guess we call it, right?
Yeah.
I don't call it Slate Magazine anymore. You had a piece at the beginning of the week which captured a dynamic that I think explains even a lot more than even what it was specific about, I think. And it's basically that there seems to be sort of like concentric circles that are going on here that are not terribly different. And I let me just preface this by saying that there was a moment, I think it was after Donald Trump had, in between the Send Her Back rally and his initial tweets about Ilhan Omar, where Bill Barr came out. I think we did a video on it. Maybe we you can find it. Bill Barr came out and basically said exactly what Donald Trump had said, but just said it in the way that was more polite in some way. But every sentiment was there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little bit more generalized, and it was a little bit more arm's length. But it was basically him reiterating this thing. And you made a point of, in your piece this week, that, well, you started with the story of Ronald Reagan and the message he left to Nixon.
Right.
Just why don't you talk about that? Because it's quite obvious what Tucker Carlson's doing.
Right.
To most people, and what Donald Trump is doing, to the extent that anybody's going to really sort of absorb it. If they don't absorb it from those guys, they're not going to get what's going on. But there's another dynamic going on. You started with the story of Reagan calling Nixon to say that those monkeys from Africa, he's surprised that they can wear shoes at the UN.
Right. And then, you know, and that's obvious. And mostly the way that the story went over was about how Reagan had said this incredibly racist thing. But there was a little point in the story that really struck me, which was that then what happened was that Nixon turned around, and Nixon believed that Reagan was speaking for, you know, a political faction that had to be listened to. You know, it was important that everyone in the Nixon administration be aware of what Reagan's people were feeling, right? Reagan was like the avatar of the deeper, harder right. And so Nixon started calling up officials and telling them, hey, I got a call from Reagan and he said this stuff and we need to be aware and we need to not, you know, we need to make it clear that we don't fully support the UN and we want to like back off and signal that this message has been received. And so he calls up, was it the Secretary of State that he was calling?
I don't have the
transcript in front of me, but he calls him up and he says, you know, I just got off the phone with Reagan and so forth and so on. Cause like Nixon has this really weird, the same way that, you know, the Joe Biden says anyway, Nixon is like, and so forth and so on everything. But like, you know, and then he says, I just got off the phone with Reagan and he was, you know, and he said, I saw all these cannibals on TV, you know, and Reagan didn't say cannibals. I mean, he said monkeys, which is terrible in its own right. But somehow this incredibly racist other term, cannibals, had just appeared and Nixon was saying it and they were chuckling over it, but it wasn't something Nixon said. Right? Nixon was saying that Reagan had said it, even though Reagan hadn't said it. But this imaginary Reagan, the imaginary Reagan who represented the silent majority, had used the word cannibals. And so it just sort of was incepted, right? It just came out of nowhere with nobody responsible for it. There it was.
Right. This orphaned bit of racism. That
yeah.
Was
just
like floating
like,
in the
it's
ether.
Like precipitated out of the supersaturated right. solution of racism was the sudden crystal that hadn't been there before.
And so you likened that dynamic to a dynamic that we see, it feels like every day. And the Times later in the week, before after you had written this piece, as if to say, like, to Slate, like, good hire, had a headline that says, Donald Trump calls for racial unity. Was that what the headline was? And
Trump urges unity versus racism.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Although the one that really jumped out at me was the one the day before, where it was like a bewildered nation confronts the shootings. Because, like, who's bewildered?
Right.
Like the bizarre thing about, I actually thought that those two headlines back to back captured something really weird about the way that the Times constructs the world, right? Which is that in its news writing, it has this scrupulous extremely narrow and blinded concept of objectivity, basically objectivity consisting of things that people will tell them and like sides of an argument that someone will officially stake out, right? So in news reporting terms, right, Trump did sit grudgingly in front of a teleprompter and call for unity with a complete lack of emotion or interest until he could get back to Twitter and start yelling about how the Democrats were the enemy. Right. So that was a fact. And so as an objective fact, the Times is like, well, it's not wrong for us to say that the president called for unity. So, and that's the sort of thing that they are dedicated to building their news stories out of, right? These like extremely narrow journalistically objective, like fact units that are assembled into what the news is. But what's bizarre about that is that then on top of it, what represents the higher calling to the Times is to run news analysis pieces and to issue these first draft of history verdicts about what's going on in completely abstract, like epistemologically indefensible terms. So all of a sudden, the Times is telling us that the nation is bewildered. Like a spokesperson for the nation called up the Times and was like, we want to register that as a country, we're bewildered.
Right. They're able to sort of just look at the fact that Trump said these things without doing any analysis or context. But then because supposedly they have this rigid set of mores and methodologies. But then the next day they essentially diagnose what the entire nation is feeling without really.
And who was bewildered?
Right.
Were you bewildered?
No.
I mean, nobody was bewildered. Everyone was like, oh, two more of these.
Right.
This happened again. And then, you know, you saw the manifesto and you're like, oh, right. Immigrant invasion. I've heard that. I've heard people talking about the immigrant invasion. I guess this guy was listening to the same people. Like there was, it was terrible and it was shocking that it happened, but it like there was nothing really confusing about it, unfortunately. It was rather straightforward.
6 months ago, I don't know when it was, when we would play clips of Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson saying invasion, we were just sitting here going, like, how do people hear this and not take up arms? Like, how does, I mean, I'm convinced that we said specifically, like, there's going to be somebody who's on the margins, who's going to hear this stuff and is going to act on it because how could you not?
Yeah, it's an invasion, you're being told.
Exactly. So. And so the bewilderment, and then it goes a little bit further with some of their opinion writers. You talk about Brett Stevens, who had, and this is, it also reminds me of the dynamic that at one point people were, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, back in the blogger age, that for a while, there was an attack on the journalistic construction of some people say,
mm-hmm.
which was a sort of a way of the speaker to, and I will concede that I am guilty of this to the extent that like I'll go on shows and when I want to on TV, on cable news, and when I want to make it sound like, hey, this is not just me speaking, I'll say my audience.
Right.
And I don't really know what my audience is thinking because I'm not in touch with all, you know, the tens of thousands of people who listen to the show. They don't. I hear from some.
Right.
But I'm taking a guess, but it gives me some authority. At least I'm blaming the audience. I'm not making it like some.
Right.
But here is Brett Stevens. And let me just read what he wrote. And then you can talk about he wrote is this is after the first Democratic debate.
Right.
What conclusions should ordinary people draw about Democrats, what Democrats stand for, other than a thunderous repudiation of Donald Trump and how they see America, other than as a land of unscrupulous profiteers and helpless victims? Here's what: a party that makes too many Americans feel like strangers in their own country. A party that puts more of its faith and invests more of its efforts in them instead of us. They speak Spanish. We don't. They're not U.S. citizens or legal residents. We are. They broke the rules to get in this country. We didn't. And people criticized him, and he said that
he speaks Spanish. When he said we don't speak Spanish, he didn't mean himself. No. He was a child in Mexico City with his international businessman father, right? So like, he didn't. God forbid. He just meant some other people who felt that way.
And I guess the question is like, to what extent is Bret Stephens hanging around with these people that he knows this?
Yeah, my sense is that he does not put in a lot of time, but you get a lot of that ventriloquism going on, right? These people are very eager. You know, you see Patrick Graffini all over Twitter, right? The Republican consultant dude who's always like, you know, I think his like Twitter bio now is about how it, like, calling attention to the differences between the coastal elites and real Americans is my jam or something. And it's like, you know what? You are a coastal elite. You're all like,
they have no particular insight here, but the point is he's carrying this message without having to own it.
Yeah. He was super offended when people were like, hey, that's an incredibly racist thing you wrote, you know, because it's not his racism. It's like cannibals. It just appeared because he was talking about what the real people believe.
Well, this is, I mean, there's some parallel on some level to like when comedians or people comedically sort of do a parody of, but that parody, we should say, is a critique. It is not an endorsement, and it's not neutral, right? Or it's not a parody.
Right.
Like, he is supposedly carrying the message of people who supposedly the people who read him can't hear, but right. He can hear them. But even if he has a certain amount of like dog whistle, well, I mean, I guess that's really just what it comes down to. I mean, I guess like if he could show up with evidence that there is, I don't know, there was 9 million people who watched the debate, 10 million people or 11 million people. Let's say he just showed up like, I have solid polling results from a million people who say exactly this.
Right.
Does it become more valid then?
I mean, I would want to know who wrote the poll.
Right.
On top of it, but, you know, but nobody ever does that. That's sort of like that's a bizarre counterfactual when you think about it, because like this is all based on like atmospherics. It's all based on the theory that the silent majority is out there and is real and is going to come smash stuff if they're provoked by seeing too much diversity or whatever. And it, you know, the one particular piece of his ventriloquism in that column, which is amazing. So I think he turned around and he has a column right now that he's flogging about, you know, where he's denouncing Trump's xenophobia, and he's saying like, absolutely, there's a direct link between the terrible language our president used and, you know, the carnage. And like, yes, that's true. You know, I'm glad you're saying it. But like, you wrote a column expressing this whole strangers in our country thing, right? People feel like strangers in their own country. You know, Andrew Sullivan in New York Magazine did the same. I feel like a stranger. Again, he loves diversity, but clearly people feel like strangers in their country, right? And, you know, that's verbatim. You can chase straight up the line to Tucker. Right. Tucker doing his segments on people who feel like strangers in their country. And like, why do they feel like strangers in their country when Tucker and Laura Ingraham are talking about it? Because they are aware. I mean, they're not even necessarily encountering them where they live, but they are aware that there are people in their country who don't look like them. And that's right. Freaking them out. Right.
Right. I mean, this is like the story of the folks living in like Minnesota, and they're afraid that the caravan is going to come and take their vacation home. They're going to occupy their vacation home in Minnesota.
Right. And the other thing about this, right, is that it, you know, all these, when you're talking about the people who feel threatened by diversity, what you're doing is you're making the entire conversation be about an intra-white people discussion, right? The thing about diversity is people. When you have like Ross Douthat at the Times writing about how social cohesion decreased since 1965, what he's saying is that the people who arrived in the United States after 1965, after the, you know, near total bans on Asian immigration were lifted, to him are not, they're somehow lesser than the regular Americans. Regular Americans have valid feelings when they object to the presence of these other people who are residents and or citizens and live in this country as much as anyone else does. Like, that's, you know, it's this fundamental decision to continue to treat the white America as the natural default at a time when, you know, it's the white Americans who are practicing real ethnic identity politics,
right,
to the exclusion of other things.
I'd also argue that there may have been other things in 1965 that may have also decreased the social cohesion.
There certainly were.
Like the fact that we allowed black people to vote. I mean, that we being a country and
the
white people said, like, we're going to allow black people to vote now. And that's going to break things up a little bit for us.
Yeah. The idea that the country was stable and cohesive from, like, you know, the Great Depression through 1965 is a hell of a story to tell yourself.
Right, exactly. I mean, if you're willing,
a hell of a story to tell on yourself.
Yeah, for who?
If that's the story you're telling.
Right. Well, it's really, I mean, this is what it's all about. It's like, I'm going to draw some lines within the country and say, that's the country.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, and I'm going to choose a demographic and say, that's the baseline of normalcy. And anything that deviates from that is abnormal in some fashion, or is in some way different.
And it has to be justified and has to be perceived from the point of view of my assumed homogeneous real America. Right. There was there's a Times reporter who he keeps embarrassing himself on Twitter so much that he actually got in trouble for it, right?
Oh, saw this.
Yeah.
This is the guy who said, those aren't Midwest values.
Right. So, like, he ended up following this chain of thought where first it was people were saying, well, actually, you know, Representative Omar is...
remind Minnesota. People, because I'm not sure. I don't know how much we talked about that over the week.
It was there's this whole business of, like, whether... These Congress people represented, you know, were an affront to America,
right?
By their existence,
if the squad was,
and so people were pointing out that, like, these people represent districts in the Midwest. Midwestern voters support them. They are, you know, there's the mythic Midwest is in fact a place that supports these people. And so this guy who's a reporter for the Times gets on Twitter and he's that's not the real Midwest.
So it came from
there it is.
Waleed Shaheed, who is from the Justice Democrats, right? He was remarking on something that, you know, a lot of people have noticed, that we're supposed to take advice from Claire McCaskill on how to win in the Midwest, even though her experience has been that she did not win in the Midwest.
Right.
Now, I think that there's a lot of valuable lessons that come from losing, but the lessons that she's promoting are the ones that she lost on. So I don't think she's actually gained any lessons. Anyways, so Waleed said... free stuff from the government does not play well in the Midwest, says Claire McCaskill. One, Rashid Tlaib and Ilhan Omar are from the Midwest. And two, Medicare and Social Security are both technically free stuff and they play very well. And then Jonathan Weissman from the New York Times. And, like, you know, it's one thing, I think, for if, like, you're sitting and you're looking at Twitter and you're going, like, this guy. It's another where you're like, I've got to jump in here.
Right.
Like, I mean, the impetus to do that is, like, you have to have a tremendous amount of self-assuredness and you've got a bone to pick here. And he goes, saying that Tlaib and Omar are from the Midwest is like saying Lloyd Doggett, Democrat from Austin, is from Texas, or John Lewis from Atlanta is from the Deep South. Come on.
Yeah.
Now, it's hard to know which part of that sentence is the most offensive.
But I kind of think you got to land on John Lewis not representing the Deep South.
I think that's probably, I mean,
I think the son of sharecroppers who got his skull busted in the civil rights movement is generally understood to represent the Deep South.
His experience of the Deep South is necessarily, I mean, this is the thing that people have to understand here with this type of construction. And it's the same thing with what you talk about with Bret Stephens here or Ross Dothow or Sullivan, is that they're not just representing what they think is an ideology. They are also enforcing this notion of where the norms are.
Right.
That define something greater than what these people believe. They defined what is the baseline. It's like, you know, someone saying like, well, I voted for Barack Obama, but I'm not going to have two non-normal presidents in a row. You can't have another woman there. It's like, it's not just reiterating that these people did not want to vote for a black person and a woman because they wanted a white male. But it's also saying that the white male is what is normal and not even normal, like normative.
Right. And this is, and you know, again, this like this particular example gets super pernicious, right? Because, I mean, yeah, like obviously, like John Lewis embodies the Deep South rather than being excluded from it. But this idea, right, that Atlanta is not real Deep South politics, you know, that there was just an election down in Georgia, and a lot of people got kicked off the voting rolls, right? And what animates these efforts, I mean, yes, it's naked partisanship, of course, like on a functional level, all the voter purges and stuff are, you know, that the Republicans are just pursuing strategies that they think, you know, will get them more votes. But, you know, they do believe something behind it, right? What they believe is that they believe that other people's votes shouldn't count, that their voters are the real voters, that if they put the screws to urban precincts, if they like kick black voters off the rolls, all they're doing is they're making sure that the people whose votes really should count don't get drowned out by the other people whose votes are worth less or mean less or are not part of the actual mainstream.
Right.
Right. And so if you say that John Lewis is not the Deep South, you are completely reinforcing the ideology behind the vote suppression.
Right. You're saying the experience of black people in the Deep South who have been there and can tie their roots to that that area for as long as anyone is just fundamentally worth less.
And the thing is, this guy doesn't even think it's an opinion. He doesn't think, right? I mean, the Times people are supposed to be circumspect about what they
Well, that's what I mean. Like, this guy's getting out there. He thinks this is like being an analyst.
Is this guy like a right-wing op-ed writer or something?
No, he's a political editor.
Jesus
he's a
Christ.
Guy. To him, this is analysis. This is like just a, sort of an objective account of what he sees on the American scene.
And it's particularly sort of striking when you think that, like, you know, like, I mean, I'm trying to get into his head and trying to assess, like, by what even being the most generous interpretation of what this guy thinks is. Like, I just paint with really broad brushes, and all I'm talking about are the political forces that are that have and do define these regions, and that's what he's thinking in his head. But that also ignores the fact that, like, if there wasn't that voter purge, it's very likely that Stacey Abrams would have been the governor there.
Right.
And it's hard to imagine him saying, like, changing his notion of the Deep South based upon those facts. It's pretty stunning. He's just basically adding a little bit to the scales in his general analysis because he's talking about white people.
Right. Yeah, and it's, you know, the whole sort of the way that American politics and American political discourse are haunted by the specter of 72, you know, is all about this belief that this voting bloc, this, you know, the people that Reagan represented, you know, the people that he's conjuring as the real Deep South, you know, the people that Bret Stephens imagines saying it's us against them, that this block is too powerful to be defied.
Right.
That it has to, that you have to reach an accommodation with however many people do think like that, because if you don't, then you're going to be defeated by the will of the people. Right. It's like they're going to get angry because you've provoked them. And that's, you know, I mean, so that one of the things that Ross Douthat wrote, you know, there's an earlier column where he was arguing, or I think he made that social cohesion argument when he was saying that the Democrats needed to be willing to bargain with Stephen Miller on immigration, you know? And he's like, you have to recognize that previous immigration negotiations have gone on between Republicans who support immigration and Democrats who support immigration. And you have to recognize that 30% of the population doesn't support immigration. And you have to incorporate their views into your politics. And it's just like, but there's not, you can't average out xenophobia and non-xenophobia to reach like an acceptable policy middle, right? If 30%, like, it's horrible that 30% of Americans right. feel this way, but you can't like drive away a
it's
certain
binary.
Number of immigrants.
It's binary.
You're either, right. And so, and also, you know, I mean,
what other examples do we have where we like stop the train? Hold on. We only have 66% on
right.
board. We
right. gotta, like, if anything else, if you have those kind of numbers on one side of a
it's
question,
land,
then
it's
the
landslide.
Other side of the question just got to go away. Cause
right.
like that's not, but instead, you know, their views have to be, you know, you have to defer to that. You have to make room for discussions about who, about what diversity in America is too much. And a piece that I didn't get into in the piece and that I regret not getting into in the piece was The Atlantic doing a whole cover story about David Frum.
Right.
Right. Like if liberals don't enforce immigration, then fascists will. Well, but
why are liberals, those the only two options? Like,
why should, so the point is that they're liberals because they're not interested in bringing about any portion of the fascist agenda, right? And this, again, this was on the cover of The Atlantic, and this was absolutely like another one of these pieces that's just ventriloquizing for this.
Well,
you know,
it's ventriloquizing, right, exactly.
And again,
because
Jeffrey Goldberg.
Again, you know, it's their hand up the ass that is
but,
moving
you know,
the,
this week, you know, Jeffrey Goldberg is doing lots of tweets about The Atlantic's high-minded moral coverage of like what an atrocity Trump brought off. But like you ran a piece that was about how people who feel threatened by immigration must be heard and must be incorporated and how we have to acknowledge that immigration went too far after 1965. Like that was your cover story in your magazine. Like it's
right.
very nice that now you're upset, but like,
and this
published
is
published this.
And we should be clear. And I'll say that the from, the Frum construction is very similar to that Sam Harris construction of if people on the center left don't get out in front and criticize Muslims, you're just going to leave it to the fascists to do that.
And, yep.
And,
yeah.
And they're going to do it in a way that's going to be rude, where we could do it in a way that's polite, I guess, is the idea. But and we should say that there's also, it's one thing to say, there is 30% of the country that have complaints that in some instances may be a function of economic, in many of those instances is more of a social complaint that they are having trouble getting used to the fact that they are not centered in our society anymore. And so we should acknowledge that. And maybe, I don't know, send muffin baskets to people or you know, let's do a proposal that says, like, you know, let's put more money into their communities, you know, into everybody's communities, let's say, so that everybody can feel like, you know, they're important in some fashion. I mean, the idea is that we need to keep their dissatisfaction alive by recognizing it, legitimizing it, as opposed to sort of acknowledging it may exist, it's bad. If society wants to get rid of it, there may be ways that we can work on getting rid of it. But from a political standpoint, that it's not incumbent upon us to do that. I mean, it's interesting you raise 72 as the specter, because that's when Buchanan basically went to Nixon and said, here's the strategy.
Right.
Polarize the country because we got the bigger half. And I think today it's quite clear, electoral college politics aside, they're polarizing the country. They don't have the bigger half.
Right.
They are using voter suppression. They are going to use all sorts of tactics. I mean, literal voter suppression and then sort of like rhetorical voter suppression as a way to try and get under the I mean, I don't think that there's anybody out there who thinks that Donald Trump can win the popular vote.
Right.
It's really just a question of can they run the Electoral College game again in some fashion. And we also see not only are these guys basically saying that this ideology, this xenophobia and racism, the adherents of this are worth 7/5 of anybody else in the country. We see that reflected in like literally we see that reflected in the way that gerrymandering has altered the votes, like in a place like Wisconsin, where Democrats win 54% of the vote and end up with 65%. I mean, and Republicans end up with 65% of the seats.
Right.
They're psychically trying to do on some level what is happening with the gerrymandering.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, that's the, you know, that they want a justification for it. And so, you know, you have to, when you're tilting the field in one direction, you know, you have to tell yourself that that's the direction that the field ought to be tilted, that there's, like, some underlying, you know, moral reason that the side that you're helping to win deserves to win. And, you know, you have to construct that reason without, you know, in the absence of having a majority of people on your side, which is usually how we've traditionally sorted out, like, which side has the better claim.
It's almost like they don't even realize they're cheerleading. They're just sort of, they have not examined their own, like, biases at all. Like, I just want to
know, absolutely,
like, the level of self-delusion that someone like Brett Stevens must have when they write this. Or this guy Weissman. Well, doesn't follow that thing, because it was pretty funny, right? Like, people went after him, and he just kept trying to justify him.
Yeah.
Would you call that smarm?
Perhaps? Yes.
That unwillingness to acknowledge one's own ideology.
Yeah, and the idea that you're calling for respect to these people, right? That it's, yeah, certainly.
Do you think that is? I mean, what's happening with that dynamic relative to the body politic? Because I think that there is that the dynamic that existed in 72, I think largely that idea, if we polarize the country, we have more of those people. I think we went through a long period where it was muddied, and I think probably 9/11, in many respects, sort of obscured what was the change that was happening on some level, right? Like, because that was, in some respects, I think that impeachment of Nixon obscured what was happening regard to the right in this country and their political power, and artificially kept maybe Republicans out of office for, I don't know, maybe 4 years or something. But I think 9/11 did a similar thing in some ways. I mean, I think that the scars are, you know, much more lasting in terms of, like, setting up institutional and structural things that make this country more right. But where do you think we are in terms of, like, the critique of someone like Weissman, who went on to say, earlier this morning I tried to make a point about regional differences in politics between urban and rural areas. I deleted the tweets because I did not realize I adequately made my point. Because I realized it did not act.
Right.
I don't remember him saying rural or urban. Like,
no.
He doesn't recognize that the Midwest also has, like, urban areas.
Right. I mean, that's you know, part of the real American mythology, is that somehow the fewer people there are, the more real it gets. And, you know, given the urbanization that's gone on, you know, over the past decades, then it's this business of writing people who live in cities out of the real America is a bizarre.
Well, to be fair, the founding fathers did not live in cities the size that we do that we do now.
Yeah,
right or wrong,
they also didn't have, like, giant agribusiness farms.
Okay,
and, you know, automated tractors to till the land.
That's so, like, also true. Or cars,
so,
phones.
You know, so I mean the whole nature of the urban and rural.
But you're just nitpicking with the other stuff. The city stuff is the important thing. That's why we start this show by saying that we're in the heartland of America.
Confused my mom.
Downtown Brooklyn.
Can we take another look at that tweet? That's remarkable.
This is an older one from 2016. It says, defeated Dems could have tapped Rust Belt populist to head party. Instead, black Muslim progressive born from Minneapolis?
Yeah.
He's doing the exact identity politics that he thinks that liberals are doing.
Right, but he's attributing it to other people, right? I mean, there's also, you know, there's long ago and far away, there's Joe Biden, who, you know, still gets it hung around his neck, the whole calling Obama clean and articulate.
Right.
Right. Obviously, Joe Biden wasn't saying that, right? Joe Biden was channeling some Joe Biden enthusiast voter who he, you know, wanted to, you know, he could convey that that his people were not going to be threatened by Obama. But he, the way that he did that was by putting it in these.
Right. Joe Biden seems to have is a conduit for a lot of that, it seems like. In fact, we have footage of Joe Biden being that conduit-y today. But the dynamic you describe here, too, also describes this notion of what is defined as identity politics. Like, the right and the center right, these folks will say that Democrats and the left are consumed with identity politics. Yet, Democrats are not consumed with an identity politics. It's that there are multiple different identities that make up the left. But when you look at the right, it is,
and this
not what 90% white,
right? I mean, and is this, it is 95%? Not, this is not a Trump thing,
right? Right.
You know, 88% of Mitt Romney's voters were white. And in the coverage of that election, I remember reading and writing about it at the time, it was taken as a given that there was racial polarization. And it wasn't racial polarization. The fact that Asian Americans and Latinos and Black people all agreed that they were voting for Obama, that means that lots of different kinds of people with different kinds of interests all had come to the same agreement about
right.
what the country needed. And then there was one group of people who disagreed and segregated themselves, you know, went and sat at their own end of the cafeteria and cast their votes for Mitt Romney. You know, and like, to say that this was identity politics, like, no, you could look at the Obama coalition and you could see people who look nothing like yourself.
If you're looking for the melting pot, it is not in the Republican Party. It is in the Democratic Party. That comes with its own challenges, but that's the fact. The social cohesion, though, of the Republican Party is stronger.
Evidently.
Yes.
And yet they all have to be spread out and, you know, in McMansions with
right.
a little bit of room.
That is the irony.
They're not on top of each other.
That is the irony, is that they're
you increase
socially
the density. Somehow, the people who are responsible for defeating, for undermining social cohesion are also the ones who live at much higher density. So,
that's right.
I don't know.
It's a very odd dynamic. But you're just looking at social cohesion in a too literal of a fashion.
Right. How well do people in a society live with each other?
Right. You're looking at it at that level, but I'm looking at a more transcendental level.
Right.
That's the... well, let's play. Can you stick around for a while?
Do
you
have, sure.
It's Friday. You guys, like when you write, you guys take off, right? Like usually by now,
know,
you
I
guys
got
are like,
no, we keep going. I got to see what Jim Newell sends from Iowa.
What is going on in Iowa? Is this where? Here's an idea of what's going on in Iowa. Let's talk about this. This is Joe Biden, and for people who have concerns that Joe Biden harbors a very, I don't know how to say this. I don't want to say like, you know, like obviously this is like where I wish there was this other word. There was like a racism word. Or something like that, because
like racist fellow travelers. Or something.
Yes,
like
or just sort of like, you know, like he's racist.
I think it's a microaggression. No,
he's racist on some level. I mean, look, the Eddie Glad was on this program a long time ago talking about white supremacy is a habit, and it is a practice that to some degree everyone in our society practices, black or white, and it's in varying degrees. And as we talk about sort of a notion that some people in this country have, that being white is the normal state of what's being, and that everything that is not white and really not just in terms of like color or race or whatever, but everything that is not that white represents, not just a color. It's like it's a position in society. It's a moral standing. It's an education standing. And that anything that deviates from that is in some way or is just like off in some fashion. Everything is defined as being off white. For anybody who's concerned that Joe Biden harbors those type of feelings, and or for those people who are concerned that Joe Biden is prone to articulating them and is not necessarily adept when his mouth starts going, I've got some very bad news for you.
And the other thing we should do is we should challenge these students. We should challenge students in these schools to have advanced placement programs in these schools. We have this notion that somehow if you're poor, you cannot do it. Poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids. Wealthy kids, black kids, Asian kids. No, I really mean it, but think how we think of it.
Now,
I mean, it's possible that that was like a really deep critique being delivered. But yeah, I mean, it's like he's so internalized the code through all the years.
Here's the good news. He understood after he said it that it was wrong to say that out loud.
That's true.
And I feel like that, like, he's not getting enough credit for that.
I mean, this is where, you know, everything that you can say about Biden, then you have to like refract through the question of what it would mean in a head-to-head. So yes, like, it's true. Saying appalling things and then noticing that something appalling came out of your mouth is a competitive advantage head-to-head in the general. Yes. You know,
but it's also even just against Biden himself, because I feel like Joe Biden, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago would not have caught on that was inappropriate.
It's possible.
So I feel like Joe Biden should be getting credit for realizing after he revealed that he thought the distinction of poor kids is white kids, that he should get some credit for catching that in time enough to just stutter a little bit and then throw in wealthy kids.
Sure, why not?
Maybe he's drawing an intersectional analysis of the historical disadvantaging of certain groups.
He's not.
Exactly.
I mean, people are also talking about him saying that we choose truth over facts as a gaffe, and that's just true. You should too. Truth is better than facts. Facts are overrated.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
The problem with that, of course, is that it's hard to imagine when we're talking about aside from it being problematic, I mean, if a guy says this on the street, you just walk away from him, right? Like if you're talking to him or if you're having dinner, you go like, really, buddy, you know what? I'm not covering the meal tonight. We're going to split. But when he could be the candidate that is picked to beat Trump, the problem is not so much that Trump would have a problem with that. I mean, Trump, if they said that in a debate, Trump would just go like, well, you had it right. I don't know why I had to add those other things.
You think? Because I think that Trump would stomp him for it.
Or
I think that Trump would, very, very happily, you know, jump all over him for having said the wrong thing.
Probably.
Even though it's something that Trump himself is fine with.
Largely irrelevant, except for the fact that I think it's quite clear, at least this is what the Trump people, and I think the lesson we learned from 2016 is that you need to get out your bases. You need to inspire. They need to do this, and the Democrats need to do this, which is inspire those people who are just marginal, who like on the right, I think it's like, hey, I've heard a lot of racist talk from people, but I really feel that Donald Trump is going to do something racist, and that's what's going to get me out to vote. On the in terms of the Democrats, they have to be convinced that the person running for president, and you're talking about people of color, largely black people, Latino people, that this guy or woman understands that we have a problem in this country And it's not just that we're not white. And I just don't think that Joe Biden's going to be able to inspire those people to go out and vote.
Well, this is the thing about, you know, seeing these kinds of analyses from political reporters, you know, and having people urging the Democrats not to provoke people by embodying diversity or whatever. It's like when the Democrats are trying to make their first political priority be not to provoke this silent former majority, you know, then they don't do the things that would make the base of people who actually support the party feel inspired to go out. If they're constantly, right, you know, cringing away from the imagined criticisms of, you know, of the real Americans, then they can't articulate who the real America is and why they're for it.
Right. Like, people have this critique of the Democratic Party where they're like, oh, they forgot to do class politics. They've abandoned organized labor. They're 100% identity politics. And that's why they lost. So this time around, they need to stop doing that. But I don't think they really ever were for identity politics either, except in a really shallow and pandering way. And it's just now, this time around, they're switching a little bit from pandering to identity politics to pandering to class politics. But they haven't done either convincingly at all.
I mean, I think there's been times you could argue where they've done that. But but as of late, yes, it's a real problem. I mean, when you look back the past 20 years. Now, I will say that I will vote for Joe Biden because Donald Trump is horrible. But if I'm demoralized when I hear that, and I know that my children's future is not incumbent upon, significant societal change. And if I know that my prospects are not contingent upon significant societal change, and I'm still demoralized by it, I got to imagine, and maybe I'm guilty of what Brett Stevens is doing, right? It's like sort of like, which is sort of like to deep, but I'm not reinforcing, I think, sort of a sense that like I have, that there's some type of baseline. I mean, I guess like the idea is, you know, like I'm presuming to know what will drive people out to the polls on some level and what they're hoping for their politicians. But I guess I'm also not promoting something that ostensibly I'm criticizing.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky to talk about, you know, what's going to motivate people the most, because it's also true that, you know, people are very aware of how bad Trump is.
Yes.
And, you know, there's going to be a lot of motivation behind that. And, you know,
I think that's going to be the primary driver, right? I mean, that's what it was in 2018, it seems like.
It's, yeah, I would think it would be. And so, you know, the idea that, like, that we'd be bummed out about Biden, like, yeah, but, you know, people can see this idea. You get into these layers and layers of people trying to attribute ideas about, like, people are trying to be their own pundits. People are trying
right.
to sort of guess what other people are going to support instead of going for what they support. So, but at the end of that process, you've still got a candidate in against Trump. And I think that, like, whatever convoluted reasoning people have followed to get to that point, they're still going to.
Well,
the alternative
they're still
going to
vote. I don't think that. I don't think that the difference between any candidate on the Democratic side is going to change anybody's vote. But it's how many people are you going to get to go out and get other votes? Like, that to me seems to be what the calculus is, right? Like, the voting numbers in Wisconsin and in Michigan, there just wasn't enough people who voted. At the end of the day, it wasn't enough people who voted. And there's a lot of reasons for why, and this is on the margins, it's a small amount of people, but part of the reason could very well be that there just wasn't enough people going out and knocking on doors. And you need to have a motivated base to do that work. And I think a lot of that work was done, the Clinton campaign thought they could do it through algorithms, and they could just model who was going to come out, and then they just assumed. Because in part of it, I think, is because they just didn't have the volunteer force to go out and canvass and realize, like, oh, wait a second, we may have a problem here. I mean, that's just what we heard from folks in Pennsylvania anyways, in terms of like...
Well, don't you think it's also the decades of failed neoliberal policies that kept people from voting? Like, they didn't think that they had anything to vote for. Like, there was no evidence that the Democrats were going to do anything to improve their circumstances in life. And they weren't necessarily wrong.
I mean, I don't think that, I don't know, the 4 years earlier, they didn't think that. I mean, I think that they may have felt like Hillary Clinton. I don't think they're making that universal of a critique. Let's put it that way. I think they're just like, I just don't think Clinton's going to deliver for me. Maybe.
I mean, it's conscious and it's unconscious, right? Because part of it is people are just too busy and too beaten down trying to survive to follow politics or to go out and vote.
Well, I understand.
But it's also conscious.
The question is like, why did you have such a drop off between 2008 and 2012 and then 2016? I mean, Donald Trump won with less votes than Mitt Romney did. And so the question is, you know, why did you have that drop off?
Well, the Clintons were certainly more associated with austerity than Obama was, I think. But I would like to get Tom's take on this, actually.
On the question of why people were less, you know, it's hard to, I'm not sure that the failings of meritocratic neoliberalism, I don't know that it's necessarily the sort of emotional response of the public to it. I think that one big aspect of this is that voting conditions got worse. And I think that when you got a party that, you know, as Alex Perrine likes to talk about, right, that you have a party of people the people who are in charge are there because they did well in their LSATs, right? I feel like there's this idea that if the conditions are unfair, well, we're going to play by the rules that are in place and we're going to win. And if we need to get like 58% of the vote to get 50.5% of the legislature, then we just got to get 58% of the vote, you know? And so this, I think that against the background of, you know, ongoing suppression and interference with people's ability to easily go out and cast ballots, you know, there's a certain complacency about that. That people don't want to talk about that because then you're being a sore loser. Then you like haven't won the meritocratic voting contest. When, you know, the message should just be to make it easier for people to vote.
I mean, I think Ari Berman did an analysis, at least in Wisconsin, that was basically, yeah, you just look at the voters who were allowed to vote in 2012, and that would have made the difference in Wisconsin, at least. And I think, I guess my argument is like, if I've got to wait in line for 3 hours, which I don't have to do in a white district, but I do have to do in a black district, and I got to wait in line for 3 hours, do I want to wait in line? You know, the difference between waiting in line for somebody that you think is going to win, right? Because everybody thought that Hillary Clinton was going to win for the most part. And you're not terribly inspired by her. You're like, I'll let somebody else do it. And it doesn't take many people to think that way. And you add in actual suppression where it's just like, I'm not allowed to vote anymore, and those things begin to add up to 10,000 people, 11,000 people, to 2%, to 1%. I don't even know what percentage that is of 100 or the whatever, the 220 million people that vote.
I mean, these things are not mutually exclusive, right?
Well, and you like, had, yeah,
it was a perfect storm of circumstances. There was voter suppression, like actual intentional voter suppression. There was the de facto voter suppression of, you know, the recession and the incredibly unequal recovery that did not help everyone and really continues to flag to this day. there's the sense of giving up that the Democrats are not going to do anything for working class people, and in fact have done terrible things to working class people. Like, people remember the crime bill. People remember welfare reform. Like, people don't forget. Like, working class people aren't stupid. And I think people really undersell this when they're talking about, they like to talk about the white working class and their economic anxiety, right? And whatever role that played in electing Trump. I think that's much less important than the economic anxiety of working class people of color and the large numbers of people who did not turn out to vote for the Democrats and never would have voted for Trump to begin with.
Although yeah. It's also important, you know, the flip side of that framework, though, is that, you know, there's the tendency to look at tens of thousands of white working class voters, or theoretically working class voters in Wisconsin, you know, as opposed to like the millions of non-white working class voters in
yeah,
California.
That's what I'm
and like
saying.
It's, like, you know, it's... when you're writing in the verdict on like who was mobilized to vote in 2016, it's like worth remembering that there was a large numerical advantage for one side still.
Like, right. In addition to like the sort of moral repugnance of centering any working class people who may have voted for Trump the last time around, there's just fewer of them than there are people who did not vote for Hillary.
Right. But Tom's, I think, point is like, why did those working class people of color in California have a different opinion than those people working class color in Wisconsin?
But the other thing too is, I think that when, you know, because of the very fact that when an election is decided by such a small margin, anything can be attributed
yes.
to it being the cause. I think you also have seen, you know, there are people out there who are arguing that the Democrats went too progressive in Georgia, and you know, they could have won a close election if that, which is, I mean, it's nonsense. But because it's a close election, they feel entitled to, you know, you can make any argument you want.
Yes.
So there you get exactly the opposite idea that, like, if they had just gone centrist, they could have, you know, I don't know, maybe their Republican Secretary of State wouldn't have suppressed the vote as hard or something.
Right.
I don't know. But, like, but that's the theory, right? When it's that close, you know, you just sort of always argue that they should have done it your way. And then
there has been a weird Democratic acquiescence to, or at least it's been sort of just completely unaddressed. You know, when you have, going back to John Kerry, you know, revealing years later that, yeah, no, there was something really fishy about Ohio. Yeah, dude, that would have been this is a problem that Democrats have had, I think, you know, from the moment that, I can't remember who it was now, said to Al Gore, like, was it Daley? I think it was Bill Daley, I think, who was working Gore's campaign. Like, Gore was like, we got to count all these votes in Florida. And he's like, Daley was like, look, black people, their votes don't count half the time. You can't complain about this stuff. You just got to take it. And I mean, there was some like quote like that, that was somehow using the fact that there's been voter suppression against black people to sort of say, like, you shouldn't fight for this election, to win this election. And you see Kerry having done the same thing, and you see the failure of the Democrats when they get into office to just pass, like, some reforms in terms of voting. Like, I understand you want to save your cachet for healthcare, but how much do you have to really expend when it comes to just sort of fair voting practices that you know are going to help you in the future to maintain power, to gain power. And to all the way to Chris Coons and Joe Biden saying yesterday, I think it was, like, we can't get rid of the filibuster.
Right. Well, I think that you can see it around impeachment as well, which is that, you know, one of the defining features of the Democratic establishment is this terror of any sort of articulated questioning of the fundamental legitimacy of anything, right?
Right.
So if you know, what they're seeing is that they believe, partly because they have this very static model of how public opinion responds to impeachment, but, you know, they think, well, you impeach Trump and it goes to the Senate and the Senate acquits him, then you have like laid bare the fact that the whole system is a joke, and that there's that the, you know, the constitutional mechanism for removing a corrupt and incompetent president doesn't work, right? And so you don't want to do that. You don't want to put, like, it's better to preemptively assume that the system won't work and then pretend that you're just not doing it because you don't feel like it, than to have a public display of the truth that the system won't work.
Right. As opposed to, we don't want a constitutional crisis, and therefore we're just going to break the Constitution. So right. to
gonna,
avoid like, people
we're
going
to pretend that this part of the Constitution doesn't exist, because if we tried to use it, it wouldn't work. And that's, you know, that seems like a pretty bad idea and a pretty bad way to run a constitutional government. But
I feel like all this shit can be explained by 3 Days of the Condor. That's basically it. That's my stance on all of it. It's all, I mean, it is a real problem that the Democrats, they keep hoping that it'll just change, and it's just not going to. Like this notion of these things that are broken, they keep allowing. They did it with Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
I mean, Obama could have said, like, okay, you're going to play this game. Merrick Garland's not going to get a hearing, instead of just sort of like letting it drag out and making it like, boy, Mitch, people are going to be really upset at you someday. He could have said, okay, I'm now going to nominate a series of justices, and I'm going to nominate an African-American woman. I'm going to nominate... My phone thought I was talking to it. I'm going to nominate a whole series of people that you're going to have to say no to. You're going to have to completely disregard, so that we're going to make some politics out of this. And he didn't do it. He wouldn't do it. A real missed opportunity. All right, let's go. Do you you want to hang out and talk a little bit about this? Because I think this is sort of fascinating. There has been a... should we go to the fun half? Freebie Friday. Let's just, we're just going to Freebie Friday it, folks. But make sure that you become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we give you extra content, like the content we're about to give you. And also, you support the free show. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Don't forget Just Coffee, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. And listen to our AM Quickie that is doing gangbusters in the morning. And it's really the one time you can hear how damaged my voice sounds when I wake up, I've noticed lately. Jamie, do you want to make a plug for the Antifada?
Oh, yeah, sure. So this week on the Antifada, we had a little boys chat episode where Sean and Andy and a little bit Jake Flores talked about the Manson murders. They set forth some very convincing theories around that, actually, how there was some really sketchy government involvement there, maybe MK Ultra. It was I was convinced. I found it compelling. Today I have a new episode of Vampire Castle, my side project with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session, wherein we talk about actual vampires. So that is out for patrons now. Check it out.
Matt.
Literary Hangover this weekend for patrons is going to be a episode on Orwell's A Hanging, which is sort of an anti-capital punishment essay he wrote before he was actually known as George Orwell. It's very eloquent, so check that out.
All right, let's talk about this, because there's a lot of issues involved in this too. Apparently there's this guy Stephen Ross, who is a private developer and a very, very wealthy man. And he has done some wonderful things. Like he has headed something called, what is it that he calls it? Like Arise?
Arise.
Arise. And this is an anti-racist organization, which is great that he's doing that work and he's putting that money in there. That is a very nice thing for him to do. I would prefer confiscatory taxes, but... that's not, you know, if he's going to have that money, it's, and he considers himself, quote, a champion of racial equality, inclusion, diversity, public education, and environmental sustainability.
That's great, because a lot of rich people are jerks.
That's right.
It's nice to hear about someone who who's supports good things.
Now, it may be a little bit early to make the assessment about the jerk part. He also happens to be the owner of the Miami Dolphins. And here is Kenny Stills. He is a wide receiver with the Dolphins. Matt tells me he's replacement value.
No, he's above.
He's above a replacement value. So he's a quality wide receiver. And he has become aware of the fact that Ross is holding, according to the Washington Post, an event. I think it's in the Hamptons. I'm not sure where. To raise money for Donald Trump. And Tom, I don't know about you, but I cannot afford to go.
It starts at $2,500. Is that right?
I don't know. I think actually tickets are priced at $100,000 for a photo opportunity.
Yeah, there's a big escalating scale. Like, I feel like it was if I remember the prices right, it was like $2,500 to get in, but then you're getting into the five figures for to be in the VIP section, and then for the photo it goes crazy.
Yeah, and then
everybody has access to the photo, though.
That's right, everybody has access. $250,000 for the package that includes a roundtable discussion. So we're looking at millions of dollars being raised.
You would think, unless it's very lonely in the tent.
Unless it's very lonely, maybe then it's just hundreds of thousands for Donald Trump being raised. And Kenny Stills has a message for who amounts to be basically his boss.
You had tweeted out in response to Mr. Ross holding the fundraiser for President Trump. Your thoughts after that tweet still and the fact that he's holding that fundraiser tomorrow?
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts really haven't changed. The tweet is what it is. So what I said.
How, for somebody who's so active in the community, especially for the Dolphins and the RISE initiative, do you kind of feel like it's almost a betrayal or a hypocritical sense, in a sense?
That's what I was saying in the tweet, is that it just didn't really make much sense to me for what the mission statement was for RISE and, what they're setting out to do. It doesn't make sense for me to be supporting the man's campaign who is... seems to be against all the things that he's trying to work towards.
Stephen Ross has stood arm. Has stood.
Have you talked to Mr. Ross?
I haven't.
Do you plan to talk to him about this?
I'm sure at some point.
What would you like to say to him?
I mean, the same thing that I've already said. It just doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't align. To be running a nonprofit focused on equality and talking about sports and equality, and then to be holding a fundraiser for a man that we know. Isn't standing up for that same cause or championing that same cause.
Good for that guy.
Seriously.
Say that about his boss.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward. And apparently, too, people should know that Ross sits on the board of, or he's the CEO, is he the CEO or he sits on the board of the company that owns SoulCycle and Equinox, which are two, I don't know if they're national brands, but they're big in New York City. And
absurdly expensive.
Yeah, they're way
gyms.
Too expensive. This also brings me, sorry, did I interrupt you? I interrupted you, didn't I?
Well, I wanted to just say that the Equinox and SoulCycle issued a statement saying they do not support the Trump fundraiser. Hmm. And this is what's sort of stunning to me, okay? He responded to criticism in a statement on Wednesday saying that he's always been an active participant in the democratic process. And this is what he said. This is a stunning statement. I have known Donald Trump for 40 years, and while we agree on some issues, we strongly disagree on many others, and I have never been bashful about expressing my opinions. So here it is. You're doing some bad stuff. Here's several $1 million to keep on doing it.
Yeah, is he going to like rake aside half the money to go to the people against Donald Trump to reflect the parts that he disagrees with, or is just all the money going to Donald Trump?
That's right. Like I could have raised $100 million, but as you know, I disagree with 60% of what you do, so here's a check for 40.
Yeah.
And this is the real base of Donald Trump, by the way. Like, I didn't mean to imply earlier that poor whites are voting for Trump in large numbers. Poor whites, by and large, do not vote. Poor people, by and large, do not vote. The people who are voting for Trump, giving money to Trump, and supporting Trump are the same people, by and large, who always vote for Republicans, which is to say people who own gyms and gym franchises and whatnot.
I mean, this is... this is, you know, this is the bottom line. You know, I don't know why people would necessarily be surprised about a guy like Ross supporting him, but it's this notion of like, I'm a billionaire and I've criticized him to his face. And so my giving him several million dollars, that
me giving him $300,000 to sit at a table with him and like,
No, he's not giving the $300,000 to sit at the table. He's probably already giving him that.
Oh,
he's supplying the tables.
Oh, right.
He's
right.
The one who's getting all the other rich people to come in and pay that.
Oh, yeah. The other guys who are going to pay $300,000.
He's corralling this.
Who like, also may, you know, they probably also disagree with him on important things.
Who they very well may.
Yeah, they feel bad about it.
But I'm willing to pay him $250,000 so I can sit at a table and tell him I disagree with his trade policy. And here's the thing is that, and I already hear Dave Rubin on Twitter bemoaning the fact that everything has become so politicized. Like, you know, like they're friends. And I think this should be the rule. You can have friends.
Sure.
And you can be friendly with Donald Trump if you want. In your
buy him a beer.
Well, buy him a beer.
Buy him a soda.
Buy him a
Diet
soda.
Coke.
Exactly. But when you do a political fundraiser for him, that's a political act. I mean, it almost goes without saying, since the word political fundraiser is part of the word the words political
and
fundraiser.
And it's not even just like, well, he's my friend. He's running for office. I feel like I should give him some money. You are bringing other people in. You're asking people to come and give him even more money, right? It's not, you know, that's not, I mean, I wish my friends would do that for me.
Your ability to do this is predicated on all those businesses that other people buy or pay for. And so you cannot divorce the enormous amount of money that you are arranging and providing for Donald Trump's political campaign from the way that you raise it. And so the idea that, you know, that these things shouldn't be politicized is absurd.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a big sports head, but it seems to me if ever there's an industry very ripe for being taken over and run by the workers, it's professional sports, right? Because these people have a skill that is very difficult to replace. And what do the owners do? Like, nothing.
Well, that's not true. They're the ones who get the tax breaks and the funding from the cities.
Oh, so. Right.
That's true.
They're the conduit. They're the ones who show up in a sweet ass car and convince some local bureaucrats.
Yeah, actually, we should try to get athletes to take some more initiative on that sort of thing.
There's really no reason why, like, they couldn't do it.
It yeah, seems like the stage is set.
Like, you just have the unions basically just say, like, guess what? We're going to set up our own. And I don't know. At first, what you need, I mean, you would.
I mean, you'd think that, but. I just feel like there was a. I think that there were some really grim lessons to be learned from the Colin Kaepernick situation, right? I feel that I feel it just seemed like.
You mean in terms of who the other players are?
No, in terms of like what owners and fans are willing to sacrifice for the sake of their politics. You know, I mean, you've had lots of. There's such a rich history of teams employing like terrible people and being like, look, you know, I don't like what he's. Been serially acquitted of, but you know he helps us win and we got to make it happen. And you know they had really effectively created this idea of sports as this amoral realm where like if you could contribute to the team you were going to be in no matter what. And then NFL teams chose to lose games rather than employ Colin Kaepernick, right? They like
right
they chose to bring out guys who were objectively terrible at playing quarterback and to lose football games and to have like, you know, tens of thousands of people sit in the stadium and watch some schmuck throw the ball into the ground rather than let Colin Kaepernick have a job.
Well,
and so when you see
that though,
I mean, it's the the owners in the league, but the and you know
that's the what
fans,
I'm saying. The
but the fans kept showing up.
The fans kept showing up,
right? So that's a really sort of grim measure of how much they feel like they can damage the product for ideological reasons and not suffer for it. So,
well, the idea of the players taking over though is a different one. Like you'd end up with the same product, and it would just like they would just own equity. Like it's almost like the argument they make about things like Uber. Like if you could get, it's harder. I think in some ways it's harder to do it with Uber drivers to get all of the Uber drivers who don't know each other. They don't show up at the same place to work. They don't hang out in the same place. If you could get them to get a loan to develop to an app developer, then boom, you're in business.
Then the drivers are losing $5 billion a quarter.
What's that? Well, probably not needing to do the same. They don't have the same sort of like
predatory overexpansion, right?
Exactly. And yes.
Well, Uber. The NFL outlawed, for instance, what the Green Bay Packers situation with their city there. And I think if a city like Green Bay can do it, I mean, maybe it's easier if it's smaller, but I mean, financially, they can handle it.
All right, but it's not just. This is not theoretical, the idea that people don't like the idea of political boycotts. Ben Shapiro, here, just go, zoom in on Ben Shapiro's thing here first. Here's Ben Shapiro. This is, I'm not sure, Tom, if you're aware of who he is, but he is pillar of conservative intellect in the country.
Yeah, I got a whole sidebar on Ben Shapiro if you want it.
I do. Let's do this video. Let's talk about this first, and then I want to hear the sidebar. But Ben Shapiro went on to say, "Oh my God, OMG!" He's really down with the kids. He's younger.
He's the cool kid. So hip philosopher was it? I forget what the time said.
And OMG, the guy who owns Equinox favors. I'm surprised he didn't say faves. But whatever. Equinox favors a candidate half the country doesn't like. The only solution is politically segregated gyms. Surely that will be good for the country. And the idea is that somehow, like, you've politicized everything. Is it Equinox all around the country or just in New York?
That's a good question.
I think it's all over.
I don't know.
We're all such coastal elites, we don't even know the answer to that. Right. Also, not to be pedantic to the cool kids philosopher, but it's more than half the country that doesn't like Trump.
Right, indeed.
Yeah, that was a little bit of finesse he had there.
And Cody Johnston.
Of Some More News.
Of Some More News fame on YouTube, just wrote back, Ben, period. And retweeted Ben Shapiro tweeting, I canceled my Sports Illustrated subscription after 16 years last year because of the leftist politics. And so Ben Shapiro, this guy is too sharp. You can't get away with this. Sorry, Cody. Uh-oh. He writes back, I'm sorry, you're too stupid to recognize the basic difference between canceling a magazine because of the content of the magazine, that would be the leftist politics in the magazine, presumably, and canceling a membership to a gym where I like everything but the owner happens to donate to a politician I don't like. So the idea being...
Why is he deplatforming Sports Illustrated from his mailbox?
Well, he's deplatforming Sports Illustrated, but the reason is because he doesn't like the content. He would never, for instance, say, I'm going to stop my doing business with you in whatever capacity I'm doing business because of a political opinion or action that you have that has nothing to do with my business. That's what he's saying, Cody.
Yeah.
You're so
stupid.
The
basic difference.
Yeah, it's very basic stuff.
It's a clear distinction.
And then Cody tries to shoot back with, hi, my good friend Ben Shapiro, who has not muted me, and thus everyone knows that you're reading this, just thought I'd pop in to remind you of the times you organized boycotts against Mozilla and Ritz Crackers, despite having no issue with the quality or content of their products. And here's a story. Ben Shapiro's website protests Mozilla after co-founder's resignation over Prop 8. Now, that's weird. It seems somewhat inconsistent with the point that Ben just made.
Yeah, was Mozilla's content getting to Prop 80 or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Too anti-Prop 80.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because you know that some of the HTML I heard at that point, like if you tried to bold anything on your website, it would just immediately redirect you to an anti Prop 8 site. And then, of course, there was this. Who could forget this? I think just about everybody, because it was insane. Almost 20 years ago, Al Sharpton referred to Caucasians as crackers while speaking at Keene College. And this is from Time magazine. So, of course, nearly two decades later, conservative activists have called for a boycott of Ritz Crackers, which advertises on Sharpton's MSNBC show. Sharpton doesn't dislike all crackers, boycott leader and Breitbart news editor Ben Shapiro writes on the Truth Revolt website.
This is almost like an ad for Ritz Crackers.
It's
so. When was this? When was this boycott?
Well, if he
tested
at Breitbart, this would have been probably like 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, so I'm just trying to like subtract 20 years plus however many other years from Ben Shapiro's age.
Hashtag not all crackers.
How long he's been carrying this grudge around. How long he's been sitting there with...
This is from 2013?
The Ritz crackers, yeah.
So it would have been 93 is when Sharpton referred to Caucasians.
So almost 20 years. So it would have been 94 maybe?
How old is Shapiro?
Well, he's not as young as he is marketed as, right?
Do we know how old he is?
But I really am curious at what age he would have us believe that he tucked his grievance about
35.
Oh, he's 35.
Oh my God, he's older than me, lol. That's funny.
So 35, that would have placed him, how old would he have been in 93?
About 10, 9, 10.
Now, it's very possible his mom said, "Here, Ben, here's a cracker." Just like what Al Sharpton called us.
Could be. I mean, you know, it's old enough to be politically aware.
And he could have been like, damn it. Someday.
He was streaming on YouTube, I think, like about 3 years after that.
That's right. That's what's inspired him. What is the sidebar?
The sidebar is just like, I don't know. He's managed to keep himself in the discourse. I just feel like if you like, run like a Twitter search on his sort of basic like positions on race. It's disgusting to me that this guy's even at the table. Like I've given up on like, you know, I resist the urge to even dunk on him on Twitter when he says stupid stuff. Cause I don't want to engage with him on that level. I just feel like this is a guy who's like, you know, called, Ferguson a hoax. Not, you know, not the contested details of Michael Brown's shooting were a hoax, but like Ferguson was a race hoax. Skip Gates was a race hoax. You know, go to hell. Like, right. I don't need to hear from you, kid.
I do like it though when somebody owns him and shows that his, you know, cool kid's philosopher, I'm talking really fast, therefore I'm smart, intellectual framework is completely a lie.
Yeah, he's a dope.
Well, speaking as someone who does engage him on that level on occasion, the important thing is that you make it difficult for people like the New York Times to write something like that about him. Like that's I don't care about Ben Shapiro at all as a human being, or as any entity. I'd be perfectly happy to have him sitting in his apartment saying this stuff or at the wherever he wants. But as public discourse, the idea is to sort of make sure that he is not promoted by what is considered mainstream.
Right. That's just when the Times does it, in addition to the recognizing that he's an idiot, though, I wish they would just like recognize that he has, you know, a history of being the straight out racist and in a way that's like it's not even like sort of Tucker Carlson level cuteness. It's just like.
Yeah, he called Colin Paul, I saw in an old tweet, called Colin Paul an affirmative action, you know, hire basically.
Oof. Yeah, that's like pretty rancid.
You want rancid? We have more rancid. So here is, this is a clip. As you know, there were about 680 immigrants who were rounded up in Mississippi?
Yeah.
I think they were mostly in Jackson, Mississippi on Wednesday night. The largest was at a Coke agricultural, factory. And there is some question as to whether it was a coincidence that all these people were rounded up after there had been numerous complaints to government agencies about the working conditions at these places, as if there was a message to be sent. You're here so that we can exploit you and keep you terrorized in some measure. We appreciate the work you're doing, but we're going to underpay you. We're going to sexually harass you. We're going to harass you on the job. And you're going to take it. Otherwise, we'll put you in jail and separate you from your children. There is other footage you can find out there, too, of people at these places calling for their mom. Let's play this clip. This first one is an 11-year-old girl. Her name is Madalena Gomez. Let's just leave it at that. I don't want to give the whole last name, frankly. She was on the Channel 12 news, I guess the local news. And here she's just, I don't know where they found her, probably outside of the ICE facility or maybe outside of the factory.
We're not doing the best. So I want my dad to be free and everybody else. And the little children are crying because of their daddy, mom, missing. I don't want my dad. No, the Hispanic people are not doing nothing bad. They're not stealing nothing. The immigrants just went just inside the company just get our dads out of there. That's not fair, immigrants. Yeah, just see what I'm doing. I'm crying because of my dad. I have a lot of heart for that. A lot of children are crying and their wife and their husbands are left because the immigrants took them. I can't do nothing but please open the door for the parents. I'm stuck over there in jail. I'm not going to have nothing. It's the first day of school for me. My dad bought everything for me to live over here. The rent. And I don't know what I'm going to eat. And I'm so lonely right now. I need my dad for me. My dad didn't do nothing. He's not a criminal or something. That's what the immigrants took them. Please let him free.
She uses the word immigrants for ICE in this because she's only 11. And the idea that, you know, I don't know how many of those 600 or 700 people have children, or wives or husbands or sisters or brothers or parents or whatnot. But I mean, don't we all feel safer now? Don't we all feel like we're in a better position, and those jobs now, I guess, presumably are going to open up for Americans, or are they just going to take, I don't know. Maybe they'll now, then the next crew of immigrants that they get in there will understand that you got to take the abuse.
They'll know what's up.
God damn it.
Or you're going to be sent back.
Yeah, this is, it shows exactly why the criminalization of migration is absolutely a capitalist project. And it's absolutely a ruling class project. Because when you have videos out there like this, when you have people scared that their kids are going to be crying and have nothing to eat and can't get to school, they're going to be a lot less likely to try to form unions. They're going to be a lot less likely to stick up for themselves. And that's exactly what the ruling class wants.
And if you are wondering, like, what kind of punishment are they going to give to the Coke organization? As far as I know, none. We may end up seeing some type of fine. There was an interesting piece in the Times today. For nearly two decades, the Trump Organization has relied on a roving crew of Latin American employees to build fountains and waterfalls, sidewalks and rock walls at the company's winery and golf courses from New York to Florida. Other employees at Trump clubs are so impressed by the laborers who did strenuous work with heavy stone that they nicknamed them Los Pisipa Piedras, Spanish for the Flintstones. And for years, their ranks have included workers who entered the United States illegally, according to two former members of the crew. Another employee still with the company that remains to today said that. President Trump doesn't want undocumented people in the country, said one worker, Jorge Castro, a 55-year-old immigrant from Ecuador with legal status who left the company in April after 9 years, but at his properties, he still has them. So, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And here's another clip from those same ICE raids. Just horrible.
ICE raided several companies across Mississippi this morning all at once. The operation took nearly 700 people into custody.
Wednesday morning raids took place, surprising workers on site. But in the afternoon, U.S. Attorney Mike Hurst unveiled the details.
HSI special agents executed administrative and criminal search warrants, resulting in the detention of approximately 680 illegal aliens.
One of the sites was at the Petco Foods in Canton. Tony Frazier says he works there and saw what happened.
All of a sudden, they're crying, and he's handing you a letter to give to his wife and his kids. You know, so,
families are now trying to find their loved ones, like 10-year-old Stephen Matias, who's searching for his mother.
We can try to get her out so that she doesn't experience, she doesn't want to go back to the life she was back in her country.
The acting director of ICE says each case is handled on an individual basis.
Some of the parents that were arrested will be released. They'll be placed on an ankle monitor and be monitored throughout the pendency of their immigration proceedings.
This is an ongoing federal criminal investigation.
It's just unbelievable. All of these people are paying taxes. For one moment, step back from let's just put ourselves in the minds of someone who's just completely inhumane. From even a practical standpoint, what is the upside to this? These are all of these people are paying taxes. The taxes are deducted from their paychecks.
Well, I think it keeps the workers scared and frightened and afraid to stand up for themselves.
I'm talking about the practicality. I understand what the practicality is to people who want to exploit these people. But I'm just saying from anyone else.
For anyone else, no. And I think people can understand that, which is why I get annoyed when people say, oh, the left should only focus on mass action. Immigrant rights don't affect everyone. They absolutely do. And the average worker understands that. They don't want their fellow worker to be taken away and locked in a cage.
Right. I mean, you talk about social cohesion. There's a, there's this guy who saw, I don't know how many dozens of guys, folks that he would work with on the in the factory, taken away and watching their families and watching their kids cry.
Getting a note to give to kids from a parent.
It's just,
the thing about it is too, that this is like a spectacle, right? ICE decided to do this.
Yeah.
ICE decided to do this within a week of an eliminationist massacre of immigrants, right? Somebody went to the Walmart and slaughtered people because they were furious about the immigrant invasion that the president and Fox News keep talking about, right? That happened on the weekend. And then nobody at ICE said, well, maybe we should back burner this one. The opposite. Right. They escalated. And, that's the thing. That's the context for the Trump calls for unity versus racism or whatever. That this same week as somebody freelanced a massacre in support of the anti-immigration messaging, the federal government escalated its own enforcement actions.
Came in with their own body armor, their own weapons. And this time, at least, what they did is they, instead of just separating the families by killing them,
Right.
They just they put him in jail.
You know, and the footage of the crying children. There's there's some. You know, some people have criticized, should we be like putting the cameras on these children in this time of the trauma? But it's just, to me, it like felt exactly like the footage of the kids being let out of Sandy Hook, that like an atrocity had happened.
Yeah.
And these children were suffering because of something terrible that had just been done. And like that, you know, and people I think have reacted to it on those terms too, you know, and again, and also the thing is, right, that we're having this news cycle about SoulCycle, right? We're having this news cycle about, are people being too mean to Trump supporters this week, right? Like, Joaquin Castro tweeted out a list of El Paso-based, or San Antonio-based, right? Because he's from San Antonio, tweeted out a list of the people who maxed out their donations to Trump. You know, and then there's like a tantrum about doxing people for their political beliefs, which, you know, I mean, their addresses weren't included. It was just their names. But like, should people be targeted for their support of Trump? And what happened is we've fallen into this, you know, one side, then the other news cycle, where now we're going to have an argument about whether Trump's opponents have been too rude and uncivil and whether it's fair to target people who support Trump, you know, in these ways, and you know, with these boycotts impinging on people's
livelihood, freedom to
participate,
right.
Livelihood and you know, ability to freely participate in the democratic process. And so, you know, I was like tweeting about this earlier today, is that there's like two ways you can construe this week's news cycle. You can have this one, right, where like Trump did something controversial and then has the backlash against Trump gone too far? So that's one way you can talk about what's happened in the past week. The other way you can talk about what happened in the past week is what we were saying before, which is that there was a massacre against immigrants, and then there was a heavy federal law enforcement action designed to put on a public show of suppressing immigrants, you know, and
all the way supporters raising millions of dollars.
And along the way, supporters raising millions of dollars for him. Right. That is, are we talking here about a sort of cyclical politics that's being transacted among the people who are politicians and, you know, political donors? Or are we describing an escalating politics of xenophobia and persecution? Right? And like, seems pretty clear to me which one is a more persuasive frame to put around this week's events.
Right. I mean, the notion of like, we have to maintain civility and we can't blame. I mean, look, what Castro did is exactly what the system is designed for, right? Like,
right.
The
You're
whole
required
reason
to sign your
why
name to your donation.
Why you have an index like this is to say that, like, we need to know who is funding who.
Right. And, you know, and there's certainly room to talk about, like, overall, given the sort of the way that Twitter amplifies things and calls to action, you know, the fact that something exists as public information is not a get out of jail free card. Obviously, like, you can look somebody's number up in the phone book and it's in the phone book.
Of course.
But if you tweet out the phone number that you looked up in the phone book, like, yes, that's a different category of thing for public record. But max donors to the president of the United States is not like a sensitive class of people. Like, you don't get to be a top donor to the president and treat that as private behavior. That's public behavior. You're publicly.
And if people are worried about that type of thing, if people feel that we don't want our politics to become so debased, where if you give money to a friend, like you're Ross, and you help out a friend who you've known for 40 years, or if you just give money, there is a solution to that. And the solution is publicly financed campaigns. If people are afraid of like having to not have their vote secret and want, you know, publicly financed campaigns, like, I mean, there are mechanisms. If we really decide, like, we, you know, you shouldn't be penalized, you know, for wanting to do the maximum to have your preferred candidate win, then let's eliminate actually giving money to that candidate. And then you're not going to ever be held account on that. I mean, there's, in other words, there's mechanisms. If we think that's a real problem, there's mechanisms in which to deal with that.
Right. And then you wouldn't have to feel bad about the parts of his agenda that you don't support.
Exactly.
You wouldn't have to, make those
then
excuses.
Then, actually, it would increase the value of you criticizing him vocally because you're not offsetting it with, you know, he asks you for money and you go, I would, except for we're not allowed to give any money. And, you know, but I think right. You're great.
So here's what I can do for you. I can praise the thing. I can praise your tax cut because I liked it.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I can criticize your other policies because I don't agree with them. And you know, now I have spoken. I've put my voice out into the public to...
And I'm a billionaire. My voice counts. Here's Mike.
They'd much rather sit back and let the white working class get blamed for Trump.
Yes.
Calling from a 610 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 610 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Hello?
Sam.
Yes.
Sam?
Yes.
Hello.
Hello.
Mike from Pennsylvania.
Mike from Pennsylvania. How are you, Mike?
I'm good. Can I just say that the deportation is one of the tactics of ethnic cleansing? So... when ICE organized that huge raid a week after a mass killing.
Days.
I mean, it's the exact same thing. It's just a different strategy.
Right.
And
Tom was just making that point.
I didn't see any executives being let out in handcuffs that had hired all those people. In fact, Trump pardoned an executive who had been convicted of hiring illegal immigrants. I think it was like 6 months ago.
I didn't recall that.
So, like,
but here's the amazing thing. On one hand, these executives are so genius that they deserve 75 times more in salary than their average worker, or 120 times more, whatever it is. But at the same time, they're also incapable of telling whether they have hired people who are not really who they say they are. It's hard. It's hard to thread that needle.
It is. It's, you know.
You have a very specific skill set.
Yes.
As a CEO.
Yeah, you have to simultaneously be totally incompetent with labor law and your basic organization, fact-checking. But very successful at directing revenue streams in ways to avoid taxes to the maximum degree.
Yeah. They don't teach that in, well, they probably do. Yeah. But
no, that's most of the curriculum. I wanted to call because I don't know if you've been paying attention to the twitch.tv platform the past couple of days.
I have not. I can't say that has been on the top of my list of things to pay attention. Why? What has happened?
Well, two major events happened within this community. And the first of which, and in my opinion, the more important one, was that I, Mike from PA, debated top Twitch streamer Destiny on the electability of Bernie versus Biden. And pretty much universally was declared the winner.
That's what I heard.
And my impromptu Twitch stream with my shitty laptop webcam received 4,000 followers overnight.
Wow.
And hundreds of paid subscribers.
Fantastic.
I know, it was pretty amazing. And then to follow up on that, Majority Report co-host Michael Brooks, as he bills himself, debated Destiny
again.
That's an odd
billing. I didn't know he was the co-host, but that's okay. We let everybody choose their handles here.
He debated Destiny as well on TPP and foreign trade agreements.
Yeah.
And, one of Destiny's fans tallied up the time speaking, and he outspoke Destiny. 5-1. 50 minutes to 10.
Wow.
Now, this Destiny.
It was pretty.
Who is this guy? Because he sounds like a pickup artist.
No. I don't want to do a pile on this guy. I mean, I know, like, you know, when we spoke to that.
He's a good guy. I'm not. He is not a pickup artist. He's a former, like, StarCraft professional gamer who got into politics and largely has, you know, in the gamer community, he's mostly a force for good. And
anti-racism, basically, right?
He says, say again?
He does, like, anti-racism debates, basically, right?
Yeah, well, we've got an interview with Caleb Kane that we're going to run during vacation, and Caleb cites him as the one who basically pulled him out of, sort of the spiral he was in for alt-right. And so, healthy contribution. Believe me, my fantasy is a world where people are having such debates, and that is the size of the spectrum of debates that are happening. That is the range where it's, you know,
And I don't want to surprise him at all. I mean, he says he supports, you know, Bernie and Warren. He just didn't understand the path because no one explains why Bernie's more electable. And I did, using voter studies. It's actually pretty interesting. If you go over to my Twitch, it's called Central_Committee. You go over there, you can watch the VOD and see the debate. And he's a real, I don't want anybody to get the impression that he's horrible in every way. He's not, he's a great guy and very generous to do that. And help promote, you know, he's a big fan of Majority Report. I know you went on, on his like business podcast, didn't you? Yeah.
Yep. Well,
so, really great guy.
People should check it out. That is Central_Committee. You don't actually spell out underscore, right? You just do an actual underscore.
No. Yeah, an actual underscore. Yeah.
Well, that is not,
thanks so much for clarifying that.
Marketing 101. But Mike, appreciate the call.
Yeah, I failed. Yeah, all right. I'll see you soon. Bye bye.
I don't know why anybody puts an underscore in the middle of their.
Because the other one is taken?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, just.
I mean, the worst, if we're honest, is putting an underscore at the beginning of your Twitter handle. You know who does that?
Who does that?
_ Michael Brooks.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
In my defense, I did not know that Twitter was going to be a thing when I chose my name. I did not think that hard about it. And it's weird because I've literally never used my middle name for anything. But I was like, yeah, why not just throw it in there?
Do asterisk. Instead of underscore.
I don't know if that's even allowed.
Is it not allowed?
No.
Oh, speaking of debates, by the way, I very much enjoyed seeing Hassan Piker debate socialism versus capitalism with his uncle boss, Cenk Uygur, the other day.
Yeah, you said that. I tried to watch it, but I couldn't. I guess I had missed the stream or something. I don't know.
I'll track it down for you. It was amazing.
Calling on a 419 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 419.
Hi, Sam.
Yes.
Hi, this is Drew. I'm calling from Toledo, Ohio.
Drew, what's on your mind?
So I had actually emailed Majority Reporters last week about the rally in Detroit. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I don't think we did.
Okay, so I was there volunteering to help out at the TYT rally outside the debate. Sorry about that. This is the first time I've ever called and gotten through, so I'm a little nervous.
Don't worry about it. You're doing great.
So Eric Bolling tried to get into our crowd to go up to talk to Cenk and interrupt things. And I was personally charged with basically body blocking him to stop him from doing so.
Okay.
And there's a link in the email to a Twitter video that he posted. But I actually signed up for Blaze TV for the trial account so that I could get the full episode, which a friend of mine uploaded an unlisted copy onto YouTube.
Okay.
And I could pass that along to you guys if you're interested.
Sure. Tell me what's in it. I don't want to get. I don't want to feel too much anticipation. Like, what is it that we're watching here?
Okay, so basically, at the beginning of it, he approaches from kind of, you know, the outside of the crowd, and he's interviewing a few people, trying to get, you know, provocative responses with his provocative questions, and
right.
He's not really able to do that much. He tried to get several people to say that it was okay for the recent people that have been throwing water on cops or something. I saw a couple videos of that.
Okay.
And then he personally came up and he kept calling out. He's like, "Hey, Sink, come talk to us, Sink." And I said, you can't hear it on the film, but I say to him, maybe he would be more willing to talk to you if you pronounce his name correctly. And then you can see him walk up to me and say, "So what's his, how do you pronounce it?" I said, "Why don't you watch some of the YouTube videos?"
Okay. But is there,
he said, okay.
I mean, I don't need every, I don't need every
yeah,
moment.
That's like, fair. That's fair.
But what was there something in particular that was of note that, you know, has, I mean, look, to be honest, look, Eric Boling, whatever his name is, he's not that relevant anymore. Yeah. With all due respect, Eric.
No, I know.
I've been there. I'm there. I'm just as irrelevant as you are. But he was more relevant back in the day, and then he's not. That's why he's trying to muscle his way in to talk to Cenk outside of Detroit.
Yeah.
I suppose it
was interesting because he decided later on in the episode, or whoever was doing the editing and producing and whatnot, they personally called me out in the lower third or the Chiron or whatever. It says, "Watch the guy in the blue shirt closely. He comes after Eric." And then I was in 15 minutes of the 23 minute episode. So I don't know. I've hung up pictures of the thing at my desk at work, and I've been telling everyone about it.
Well, all I can tell you is good for you. I appreciate it. I think that any time that you can make Eric Boling's life, just a little bit more inconvenient in terms of like his trying to generate some type of, narrative like that is good. I appreciate the call. Keep up the good work. And now I know if we ever do anything like that, who I'm going to contact as my body guy. That's, all right, time for one more call. Calling from a 702 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam, it's Bro Flamingo from Las Vegas.
Bro Flamingo from Las Vegas. What's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today, Sam?
I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Hey, I really enjoyed your guest.
He's still here.
Just want to touch on
Talk about him like he's not here.
I know. I'm sorry. I know, but I enjoyed the conversation you guys were having. But and shout out to Jamie.
Shout out, right?
You know,
back.
You guys are talking about the meat. you know, Sam, I'm getting a really big 2016 vibes from the media now, and I really think, you know, with the breakout stars, Bernie, of course, but also Warren, you know, these guys don't know what to do, and it's becoming increasingly clear, like guys like Brett Stevens, you know, David Brooks, and all those guys, you know, from the New York Slimes. I mean, they do good work, but reading the op-ed page, you're almost still reading it like it's 2000, like it's 2001, and you know. And even at the debate coverage, too, by the way, I saw Jennifer Granholm saying, "Oh, yeah, you know, Joe Biden did great." Joe Biden was literally sundowning on stage, both debates, by the way, just totally out of it. And, you know,
some of the polling, I don't think the polling is, at least after the first debate, he went down a little bit. I mean, after the second, after both debates, he went down a little bit, actually, now that I think about it. He came back up after the first debate. Maybe he'll come back up after the second debate. I happen to think that, look, Jennifer Granholm is probably has, you know, opinions about these things. And, you know, we all have some measure of motivated reasoning, I think, when we look at it, particularly if you're interested in politics. Very hard to sort of keep arm's length distance at it. But I think, and I'm curious, Tom, I mean, you're a politics editor. Do you think there's a narrative that's been created that is not been created, a narrative that has been furthered about Joe Biden after that debate that may not have reached the public yet, but seems to be congealing a little bit in the media?
I think people are worrying a bit about his age and you know, in a way that they probably were all along, but feel like they can maybe say more of it now. Yeah. You know, you do see that sort of leaking in around the edges. I mean, I think it's going to be tested as the campaign continues. Like, is he going to be high functioning, you know, in these public appearances or not? And, you know, the more he's not, the more people are going to talk about it. The more people talk about it, the more, you know, that might affect the whole premise that he is the most straightforward, electable, non-controversial right. choice for president.
I mean, I saw that.
Right.
I saw that two ways just in the past 2 days. One, of course, the clip that we played where he said that, which I don't know if that reflects his age as much as like he hasn't learned much. Like he comes from an era where that would be the sort of the present, and he still can't seem to, even from like a just a sheer political standpoint, learn to like train his brain not to reveal that stuff. But there was also a moment where he was confronted by this guy Pollack from Breitbart, and he had the exchange was not super impressive, but it was okay. But it was written like somebody wrote with the headline, like, you should have Pollack follow you everywhere because it's the only time he's been animated.
Was that when he had the aviators on?
Yes.
The aviators and the polo shirt?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I was like, who is this guy?
But the point is that is the response to that moment is also problematic for Joe Biden. Because again, it puts the baseline as like sleepy Joe. And eventually that's going to catch up with them. But go ahead.
Also, it's two things. So one more thing about that, and I'm going to the next thing real quick. But the thing is, you look at, for example, because you guys brought the New York Times at the debate, I've read the opinion columns. There was always qualifiers for Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And it was disgusting. Also on CNN, like, okay, well, Bernie did okay, but he was yelling too much, X, Y, and Z. Shut up. But the second thing I want to point out is too, like, also you look on CNN, you get what I'm saying? You like, not only was it like for you know, Joe Biden, people were singing his praises, whatever. And you also get also Rands on there, like what's his name?
Well, cable news is you know, appeals to a very narrow set of people. You know,
right.
Bernie Sanders was on Rogan this week, and apparently it's already gotten 4 or 5 million views.
It was 5 when I saw it yesterday. It,
and that is, look.
No, great.
Rogan gets one and a half million views on his average, I think, video. 5 million views is a lot of views for him to get. And 6 million.
6.2.
Right.
And that means
also,
and the velocity of the of that video going is, and you can't say this about every video, but on an interview like that, that means that people are sending it because they were impressed with Bernie. And they were impressed with Bernie so much to the point where they thought, this is revelatory, so much so that I need to show this to my friends. That's what's going on there. Because, and that to me is far more relevant than, frankly, what the roundtable said at 11:30 at night after the debate on CNN.
Exactly.
Who's still watching when the roundtable comes on? Especially those debates were grueling.
They were long.
Like, it was my job to watch those debates, and like
we did it live. We had to talk all the way through it.
I was not there for anybody's roundtable afterwards.
Same.
It was bedtime.
Right.
I was like, you know, I edit stories and get to bed.
I think
like,
your point is well taken insofar as it's indicative of a larger attitude that is in the media, but that is to be expected. There's never been a time. Where they have less relevance in an election.
To your point, then I'll jump. I'll let you answer after I say this. Because you guys were talking about what happened in 2016, you know, the margins and whatnot. Look, I'm black, and I can tell you something. Just this anecdotal data. But to a lot of black people that I talk to, you know, and by the way, you know, Sam, because you brought up the fact of, you know, there's more alternative media sources now. You know, cable news doesn't have the grip. You know, a lot of black people are tired of the lip service. that the DMA and Hillary Clinton was indicative of this. You know what I'm saying? People were fully aware, black people especially, were fully aware of the super predator stuff, the crime bill stuff, you know the racist dog whistle, the racist dog whistles and everything, and that depressed black turnout. You know, and look, I'm for Bernie Sanders, but I hope Bernie Sanders just, you know, talks, because he really has a path here. And so does Elizabeth Warren to a certain extent, but Bernie has a path here to really reach out to black voters and just – If Bernie Sanders is able to really just break through the black vote, I mean, he's making inroads, but Joe Biden would literally be history, okay?
Well,
and I think, I'm sorry, Sam, I just want to say this, but you know, and on the margins, that's what happened. A lot of black people are like, look, I'm not going out for Hillary Clinton. I'm not doing it. You know what I'm saying? She is done. But ultimately what I'm trying to say is that, you know, and you guys have been harping on this, but I just want to make this clear. You know, chasing the white moderate vote. Listen, Martin Luther King talked about the dangers of white moderates from the Alabama jail. Listen, this is a new day now, okay? Chasing the white moderate, a.k.a. the casual racist. You know what I'm saying? That's running out of steam. That's really running out of steam. To Jamie's point, you know, just catering to, you know, oh, well, the white working class, we need to get them. That era is over. And also But for the most part, most of them are all in for Trump anyway. It's time to mobilize a new base. You know what I'm saying? It's time to start speaking a new language to really get people out there now. Because I'm tired of, you know, you look at people like Chris Matthews, you're sitting there ranting about, you know, I'm just going to play and blah, blah. Shut up, stupid. Okay? I mean, it's just Jesus Christ. It's like, I'm listening to these guys like, Jesus. Like, dude, like, we need, and Bernie's represented this, we need new leadership, and it's so clear. And Sam, if you want to respond to anything, I'll jump. You guys take care. Great show, by the way.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. I mean, I think when you point out those things about Clinton, I think it definitely depressed the vote. I mean, here's the question, if you're going to think about it in terms of that, like, I mean, how problematic do you think Joe Biden is? And on some level, like I raised this, I don't know, it's sort of a silly question, but Hillary Clinton obviously was not going to go out and run on Super Predator, but people find out, you know what I mean? And Joe Biden, you don't even have to really dig that far. That's the problem with Joe Biden. When he goes out and says stuff like that, it's like, You could say we must protect Joe Biden at all costs. Let's have one primary where we do not do any damage to Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's going to say a half a dozen things over the course of the next year that people are going to go like, what?
Right.
And maybe it's more than a half a dozen.
I mean, the thing about Biden is that when Biden was in the prime of life and the most plausible presidential candidate, you know, he was going around reciting an autobiographical speech that
was somebody else's
biography. I mean, that was weird. It wasn't really like weird. It wasn't like he was, you know, it's sort of,
you're talking about when he plagiarized from Neil Kinnock.
Yeah.
And Neil Kinnock's memoir, I think. And it's like, it's not like he said he borrowed Neil Kinnock's perspective on the working class.
No, it was like, or the dad was a coal miner. Yeah, yeah. And the thing about, right, and so this like goes down in history as he like washed out of the race because of a plagiarism scandal. But the plagiarism scandal doesn't cut it. That doesn't touch the core of it.
Right.
The point is, it was like really, really profoundly weird. It was not a thing where you're like, oh, I can see this guy's kind of a hustler and he likes to tell a good story and he cut some corners to you know, get a message across and he did something he shouldn't have. Like, no, it was bizarre. It was like something came out of his brain through his mouth that was repeatedly that was just not comprehensible by any sort of like model of normal human behavior.
Yeah. I mean, it's a guy who says, I want to project an image. What image is it? And then you just like, I don't know. It's like saying I want my career to be like Bill Maher's. And then I just go out and start repeating his jokes. I think there's some fundamental,
that's even weirder than that.
It's even weirder than that because jokes.
It's like you're walking up to people on the street. You want to be Bill Maher, so you're walking up to people on the street and inviting them to to come on your HBO show with you.
Exactly.
Right? And you don't have an HBO show. Like, you, like, it's not going
to
work.
They canceled it today. I'm sorry, Tom. I know you were supposed to come on to, I had invited you to Real Time, and they screwed up what set was going to be here. So, apologies.
Yeah. It's like Rupert Pupkin. Like,
this is sort of not. This is sort of not about, this is not apropos of anything, but there's two things I want to just touch on before we go. Well, also, you should know that Jared Nadler says that we're informal. Well, let's do this. There's three little clips before we get out of here. I want to get your take on this, Tom. It's because this is, let's play this. This is Jared Nadler on Aaron Burnett. And first, this announcement from Jared Nadler.
But a lot of people say, okay, you say let's not get wrapped up in words, but words can matter when they apply to what information you can get and how the American people see it, right? So I'm trying to understand, because a lot of Democrats, they don't want to be forced to vote for an impeachment inquiry, but they presumably would be willing to vote for impeachment itself if you presented the evidence.
There's no such thing. The committee has initiated an investigation into the question, into the various malfeasances.
So in your mind, you're saying this is exactly the same as what we all call formal impeachment proceedings by another name?
This is formal impeachment proceedings. We are investigating all the evidence. We're gathering the evidence. And we will, at the conclusion of this, hopefully by the end of the year, vote articles of impeachment to the House floor, or we won't. That's a decision that we'll have to make. But that's exactly the process we're in right now.
Now, I'll tell you what's bizarre about this to me. And I've been saying this for 3 years. Impeachment is a political process. It's not a criminal process. The whole point of impeachment proceedings that he's talking about is to engage the public and basically allow the public to be part of a decision in some ways, you know, to either directly or indirectly influence their representatives who they have experienced the evidence. There is no secret evidence in an impeachment hearing, right? As far as I know, there shouldn't be. But that would be the last context you would want secret,
Right.
And because that seems to me to be horribly anti-democratic.
Unless you have some sort of national security based impeachment.
Right. And
which
that
would be, yeah.
That to me seems very scary. I mean, talk about going down that road, we'd be bad, right? So why does Jared Nadler have to say that so that we understand that's happening, as opposed to us knowing that it's happening?
That's a great question. And it's a philosophical and conceptual question that I'm really curious to see how it actually plays out. It's kind of the flip side of the false and until now prevalent belief and frame that everyone has had on impeachment, which is that impeachment is just a vote, right? And the House votes and the Senate votes and the Senate votes to protect Trump and it's over, and that's why you don't impeach, right? There's this idea that, like, impeachment is only the event of the casting of the vote, and that's been the thing, that's been the terms that Pelosi has talked about it in, and that's been the terms that all the sort of savvy political analysis has dwelt on, is that treating it as an event rather than a process.
Right.
And so this is, like, the opposite of that, right? Where it's, like, it's they're telling you, rather than saying that impeachment is such a drastic, singular event that, like, we're not going to trigger it, instead, they're saying, well, actually, impeachment is such a natural process that it's already happening.
Right. It's almost always impeaching,
which,
in a way.
If that is, which makes, you know, which makes Pelosi's self-impeachment thing even more incomprehensible than it was.
This, to me, I mean, maybe there isn't a damage to it. Maybe there's no downside to this other than there's a lack of an upside insofar as, like, I don't think, I mean, maybe if there's a Judiciary Committee hearing where everybody votes not against impeachment, then Trump comes out and says, see, I'm not impeachable. There's nothing I did was wrong. I just got exonerated again, this time by the Democrats. I mean, I think that's problematic.
Right.
But the point is, if you're going to do it, it's like trying to jump in the pool and stay dry. You should.
Although it depends, I think, on what you think the pool is. Because what, you know, I am not attributing any sort of strategic or tactical brilliance to anyone. But it's true that he's like...
Sorry, I was going to do this.
But the thing is that he is like, now you've got CNN saying, so it's impeachment, right? You're impeaching, right? You're impeaching. As opposed to saying, you know,
why are you impeaching?
How could you possibly impeach him?
Right.
Like, are you going to take this drastic step of impeaching? Like, now CNN's like, oh, but so impeachment's going on, right? We're doing impeachment? So that, you know, and if what you're trying to do is you're trying to get a very change-averse political press to accept impeachment as a reality, like maybe like slow boiling them is the way to get them to do it.
I guess, but I think that is a misread of the situation. I mean, the way to get them to talk about that is to sort of say like here's some evidence. Here's the hearings. We're calling in all of the witnesses. We're going to go to, you know, and I know they're going to court and they're trying to get this out of the way. And maybe come September, they'll start to be able to bring in fact witnesses from the Mueller report, fact witnesses on all of the incredible amount of corruption that has gone on in the administration. I mean, unprecedented, right? It was just the sheer numbers of people who have had to resign from this organization. It's just unbelievable. There seems to be, there's a multitude of grounds doing it. And instead of like banding about the word impeachment or whatever, I mean, I understand what you're saying. Like, you know, like I had a neighbor who was once like, oh yeah, no, when I get my, when I got a riding mower, my kids wanted to use it. I told them, no, you got to wait. And then I'll let you mow the lawn. And like, you know, like that type of like, make it seem like you're
right.
Make them want it. And so that they really embrace it and own it. And I understand that theory, but at one point you actually got to do the work of getting the American public to understand like the value of impeachment is, it seems to me, twofold. One is that you're filling some void and you're not allowing the Republicans to have this all about, you know, Peter Strzok's texts to his girlfriend or whatever it is. And then the other is that you're building a case against the president and then you're holding the Republicans accountable for not holding him to account.
Right.
And if, as far as I can tell, they're not doing much of either. If it's, you know, the eighth story of the day, they're not exactly filling any type of vacuum in terms of what Congress is doing, but I don't know. Maybe you're right. And I guess time will tell. When can I tell if you're right or wrong?
Sometime before November 2020, I hope.
All right. You really stretched out that timeline.
Well, you know, I mean,
you get away with a lot when you're a politics editor of Slate. Really, you can just like.
Well, I mean, I think that part of the problem is this whole weird artificial idea that there should be some sort of clock, right? And that eventually we're going to have the campaign, and that because if the campaign is in full swing, then you can't do an impeachment.
What I was saying was right, but what I was saying was more like, when do we find out? When, I mean, if you're saying that what Nadler's doing is he's sort of like dangling the lure in front of them and looking them to snap on the hook, when do we find out when we start to reel in? Like there are different stages here.
Well, I mean, obviously it's not urgent enough to keep Congress from taking August off.
Right.
So maybe after Labor Day.
Right. Here's Andrew Cuomo on CNN New Day with his proposal for dealing with gun safety. And there's something in here that just stood out that actually some folks tweeted at me, but also is highly problematic. And we cannot, you know, he frames this in such a way that this should be the Democratic position. And I don't know if he thinks he's running for, I don't know when he thinks he's going to run, but here is Andrew Cuomo.
I'm asking all Democrats, or Democrats who want to run for president and come into the state of New York, just make it a simple, clear choice for the American people. The Make America Safer pledge. Four elements: an assault weapon ban, high capacity magazines, universal background check, mental health database, red flag laws. Those four elements of gun control will change this nation.
The idea of doing a mental health database, it takes about, it seems to me, 0.05 milliseconds to realize how horrible of an idea that is for civil liberties, for overall mental health in this country, for even and for efficacy in terms of gun violence. The CEO of the APA, the American Psychological Association, has said that, you know, blaming mental illness for gun violence in our country is simplistic and inaccurate, goes against scientific evidence currently available. The big difference between our country and other countries who have similar incidences of mental illness is access to guns. And the idea that you're going to put everybody in a database based upon their mental health.
Can I see the database?
What could possibly go wrong? So,
yeah, there's a there are like a couple different issues with it. I mean, one is this thing where every one of the, we keep doing these like gun control proposals that are, you know, sort of narrowly targeted to deal with one of the many massacres that have happened. You know, but of course, you know, a lot of these people aren't, even if you're just like hitting it from a straight efficacy point of view, like a lot of these people are not mentally ill. They haven't been found to be mentally ill before they got the gun. So
right. Or maybe they're not going into treatment either. I mean, so it's like, you know, the psychiatrist, you know, I don't know if any of these.
So there is, right. And there is a, there is a theory. This is like an existing gun control proposal. And the idea, I think the sort of like least appalling version of it is that this is a way of coordinating the records of just like people who've been, you know, if you've been adjudicated to have been, criminally incompetent, you know, to have been incompetent in a criminal case before, then that goes in a database, so you can't like afterwards go get a gun somewhere else, right? Like there's a vision of the database where it's just a log of people who have been adjudicated to be insane in
public
criminal justice proceedings. But so, and you know, maybe that's something that would be of some use in regulating the guns. But here's the thing. There's a magisterial piece in GQ magazine several years ago about gun tracing, right? Do you remember when this piece happened? Jean Marie Laskus wrote it. And she went and visited the people who do gun traces, right? They do it on paper because it is against the law to have those records in a searchable database.
Right.
When you fill out your background check forms and you file it with the government, it's on paper and they can put it on microfilm, you know, so it's easier to scroll through, but somebody has to read that visually. So if you're talking about, you want to establish a database that can be used in law enforcement to address the problem of gun violence, it seems like maybe taking the information about the guns that is currently prohibited from being in a searchable database and bringing that into the 20th century, let alone the 21st, would be a more straightforward reform.
And we should be clear. The reason why that is because there are lunatics who believe that the reason why these people have these guns is to fight the government, a tyrannical government, and you don't want to give a future tyrannical government the information as to who has the guns.
Right.
Because presumably when we have to fight this tyrannical government, we'll all go to the homes of the people who have the guns down the street with the people with the guns. And when they go to the homes of people who don't have guns, now that we'll be armed from our neighbors, we'll be able to ambush them because they don't know which house to go to.
That's
to
right.
Get the guns. And we all know that these teams that they're going to send in to get us, the homes with the guns, but they don't know which one those are. They're not armed well enough, and we'll be able to take them.
Right. I mean, so that's like
you know, if you're so before, that's one thing you could do before you do the mental health database. You could repeal the, what is it called, Protecting Lawful Commerce and Firearms Act, whatever it was.
That's the immunity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, you could, if you sort of kept track of where the guns are and you kept track of, you know, and you made it possible to be liable if, say, some 18-year-old who is, like, basically incapable of functioning buys a gun from you because you told him that he's going to get his man card back with his AR-15. You know, if you could, if there was a downside to that for you as a gun company or as a gun dealer,
right,
then
this,
you know,
is a classic case of private enterprise privatizing the profit, socializing the cost.
Yeah,
I mean, this is the it's a classic case of that. And I mean, personally, your product kills people in the way that it was meant to be used. You get sued, and put gun locks on there. Put fingerprint locks. There's technologies out there that can make this a lot safer.
I mean, yeah, we need to go after the corporations and the bosses and the profiteers in a very across-the-board kind of way. I think anything that beefs up the surveillance state or the carceral state in a way that can be applied unequally is going to inevitably be used against the most marginalized people in our society.
Yeah.
There's that. I mean, you know, you have this, it's like the discourse around the filibuster, right? They're like, well, but if the Democrats come back in power and they get rid of the filibuster, then the Republicans will just use it again. There's this whole, right, there's this discourse where on certain subjects you're like, well, you don't want to put that tool in the hands of the wrong people, but like you want the Trump administration administering the mental health database of everybody?
Right.
Right. I, you know,
we totally, yes.
Been looking at some files. Got some information I want to share with everybody on Hannity tonight.
All right, lastly, on a day, or I should say the other day, the IPCC came out with a report that basically said, we've got to change the way that we make food, that we grow food, because it's unsustainable and it's causing the... Maybe death of the planet is not the precise term, but I think that's pretty close. The IPCC released a report on Thursday arguing that humanity, this is according to Matt Simon, humanity can't truly fight climate change without addressing the land problem, habitat degradation, deforestation, and soils destroyed by agriculture.
Is it wired, maybe?
I think it is wired. Yep. And now we use nearly three quarters of world ice-free surface and waste a quarter of the food we produce, while the global food system contributes to 37% of our greenhouse gas emissions. The only upshot is that my understanding is that the... they have now calculated that the ice in the Arctic should be all gone by 2024. So there theoretically could be a little bit more land mass. I mean, that's mostly water up there.
Yeah.
But so we have a an ongoing rolling climate disaster. We've just come out of the hottest month in the records of human history that we can at least calculate, which is, I mean, pretty substantial. And, however, we have Fox News to tell us that this is all basically a hoax.
Say more meat and cheese and rice for me. I mean, this is, no, but that's, and my seven kids, which I have, by the way, I need to feed them all. And I'm going to feed them a good Midwestern diet of lots of beef and lots of cheese and lots of rice and lots of wheat, all the staples.
Do you feel a little guilty here? I mean, are you totally dismissing global warming and climate change?
Totally dismissing this. Global climate change is all about control. What is more about control than food? I mean, that's how I control the activities of my kids as a parent. Really, it's like you will ask permission, you will sit down, you will ask to be dismissed from the table. It's the ultimate control mechanism. If you now then say to these poor countries around the globe. I think it's a 50%, 3.5 billion people in the world rely on rice as their staple food.
They do.
And the UN's going to say can't grow it as much, especially in a lot of third world countries where populations depend on it as a primary food source, because we're more worried about the temperature change, which is something, you know, they say the science is out on it, but I know plenty of people that say there's been fudging, there's been ways in which they...
Pause it. Let's just catch up with some of this. So the idea is that the UN is trying to control people by saying don't eat so much meat and cheese, and basically because factory farming contributes so much, particularly meat.
Because they're usurping your role as a parent in using food to control your family?
No, they're the parents of the children. The UN is the parent, and they're saying you need to eat different types of vegetables, and that's the way they exert control. And then, theoretically... you got to eat all this fake meat. And then, of course, what happens is you get a little bit, don't have protein, so you get, more wiry and easier to push around. And then I would also add, I mean, I think that I'm just trying to grok the theory here. And then apparently Pete Hegseth knows some climate deniers.
That's a shock.
Well, it gets very convoluted when he starts...
Okay.
When he starts talking about the third world, right? Because he's saying, you liberal elites, you're scaring people in the third world by telling them that climate change is going to cause famines, and then they're all going to try to migrate, and then, you know, our hands are tied. We got to put them in camps. Like, this is actually a phenomenon that is going to happen, and it is already happening. It's just really the result of climate change.
I don't know. I think Pete Hegseth really is concerned about people's diets and, as he says, third world countries.
I know plenty of people that say there's been fudging. There's been ways in which they've cooked the books to make it look like the world's going to end in 10 years. I'm not sold on that whole. We've heard that before. It was global cooling. It was global warming. Now it's climate change. Everything, when it's raining, when it's hot out, it's all part of the problem.
It's weather.
It's weather. No, but in the left.
Am I wrong to remember that? Wasn't it the Bush administration that came up with climate? Like Frank Luntz came up with climate change because global warming was too scary? Isn't that the origin of that term?
Climate change was definitely like
a softening
of global warming. Yeah. Right.
It's not warming; it's just changing.
But they should know that cooling, warming is climate change, and weather is weather. But the preponderance and in structural changes in what weather you get in certain areas, that is climate. But
problem. It's weather.
It's weather. No, but yes. And the left wants to fight things that they can't see that are easy to fight, like the weather, but they don't want to fight, you know, enemies with faces like Islamists in front of them who would like to take away their entire livelihood.
I think we know
exactly.
That's collapsing sometimes, a lot of things together.
Sometimes at the end of a segment, you get a little tongue-tied. You're just like, the Islamists are trying to steal their
jobs.
That
was like a Fox Business segment generator.
That was, yeah.
Well, the Islamists are coming here to take our jobs and steal our weather machines.
He's a Midwesterner who doesn't believe that that people are capable of doing any damage, right?
It shows how connected he is to the common
do you remember
man.
He's
off point. Well, wait. He's off point because most of them now deny that it's man-made, not that it's not happening. And he's
keeping it old school.
He's in 1.0 of climate denial, not the 2.5 version that they roll out today. He obviously is not aware of the multiple 100-year floods and droughts that have taken place this year in the Midwest.
Yeah, I was going to say, if he were really a Midwesterner, he might be up on that.
All he needs to do to get your real Midwest bona fides, eat meat. Eat cheese, eat wheat, eat rice, be white. That's it. Boom. Five things.
Talk about
real America. Real America. All right, let's take one more call, and then I'm sorry, folks, we're out of time. Calling from a 928 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hey, what's going on, Sam?
Not much. What's going on with you? Who's this?
All kinds of stuff. This is Nate from Queens.
Nate from Queens. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, oh man, stoked. Okay. Anyway, I want to talk about one thing, but before I do, let me just thank you guys for being a really important part of me being a former Ron Paul guy.
Ooh.
And now a Bernie Sanders guy. So
wow.
That is thanks in no small part
I'm
to
gonna give you one of
majority
these.
Support and
hell yeah.
We're going to go right to the morning zoo.
Yeah. Well, and even more so, like, now I'm reading, like, Bakunin and Kropotkin and shit, thanks in no small part to Jamie and the Antifada, so shout out to you guys.
Oh, hell yeah. That's awesome to hear.
Yeah, totally. And like I said, I'm a queen, so hopefully I'll see you at a DSA event sometime.
So do you
anyway,
know Archie?
On to what I was trying to say.
Do you know Archie the construction worker?
What, say that again?
Do you know Archie the construction worker who was who rode into Quillette?
He had a brief career with Quillette.
Yeah, I hear tried to attend a DSA meeting and was horrified at our measures to be more inclusive.
Oh no. He like scared because you were snapping instead of clapping.
I think
shit.
You did not hear the story, but somebody wrote into Quillette with wrote a piece for Quillette that was actually sort of a hoax. But all right, we will talk
okay.
more about that.
All right. Anyway, there's something really important that I'd like to talk about, and I know that it, in the grander scheme of things, it may not seem that important to people. But so, what's going on in the state of Alaska? I'm Alaskan, born and raised there. But what's going on in the state of Alaska is really, really fucked up, right? Or messed up. Sorry, I forgot about YouTube rules. Really messed up right now, and I think it needs a little bit of people need to know about this. So the Alaskan PFD check, the permanent fund dividend, a lot of people know about this. It's a check that everybody gets every year, right?
Right.
Everybody gets – it's usually like $1,000 or $1,500. There's
a
guy
named Mike
Dunleavy.
The proceeds of the oil resources that are taken out of Alaska.
Right, yeah. It's a portion of the interest that is accrued on a permanent account that was created by the state of Alaska in the 70s, blah, 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 whatever. Anyway, point is, it's a check everybody gets, and there's a guy named Mike Dunleavy who is a recently elected governor of the state of Alaska, and he was elected on a platform, basically, of giving everyone a $3,000 PFD check, right? So this guy was elected on the promise of basically just giving everybody a huge check, like, hey, I'm going to give you a bunch of money, vote for me. And he won. Unfortunately, the other things that he was running on are super detrimental and super messed up for the state of Alaska. So he is slashing the state education budget by over 40%. He has slashed the state transportation budget by a similar amount. He is slashing research budgets, arts funding. He's slashing, just destroying the budgets for tiny, underserved indigenous communities all over the state. He is basically, the way that I think is the most accurate description is he's trying to do a brownback speed run. He's trying to do to Alaska what brownback did to Kansas, but he's trying to do it all in one hot shot. And he's succeeding because he is abusing the powers of the governor, and he is going against the wishes of the people that live in Alaska. And it's really distressing to me, and honestly, like, kind of, you know, gets me in like a weird emotional state, because I have always been thankful for the services that I experienced there. Like, I had a pretty damn good high school education as a result of the funding from the state of Alaska. And it killed me to see those services disappear. What's really interesting about this, though, and what makes it more of like I'm just going to turn my AC off so I sound better, maybe. But what's really interesting about this is that this guy is not only Koch funded, but super Koch adjacent, and has been connected with Koch Industries for years, since he was serving as a state senator. In fact, while he was campaigning, he literally toured the state with people who worked directly for Koch Industries.
and now has appointed people, several people, to state offices who are attached to or at least affiliated with Koch Industries in one way or another through either their, you know, political octopus thing that they do.
All right, let me tell you just like, you know, I think we get the picture. I mean, two things occur to me. One is it just sounds like a libertarian paradise, and particularly, and I don't want to relitigate this, but when Andrew Yang went on Dave Rubin's program and talked about getting rid of the $600 billion boondoggle that is our welfare state.
Right.
And I'm not quite clear what constitutes that $600 billion. It was not specifically drawn out annual budget. When Yang said, like, well, eventually the Freedom bucks will replace it because it's going to be more largesse for most of those people and they're going to opt out. When I hear that the guy's going to go in, offer double the checks, but we're going to do it by cutting all these services, I get pretty nervous because that seems to be totally. And this is, I mean, the only thing I can say, and there's no consolation here, because the worst part, it seems to me, about the Kansas experiment was that we learned no lesson from it nationally.
Well, the thing, too, though, I think in Alaska, right, is that it's in a way it's worse than the Brownback speedrun or Bobby Jindal, too, because he's like actually explicitly just saying that he can cut the University of Alaska to pieces, right, because he's just saying Alaska doesn't really need a state university. So, like,
yeah,
at the worst of, like, Jindal,
it
was, like,
really interesting.
Right, it's just, like the Bobby Jindal, Sam Brownback thing was, like, well, we're going to, like, cut the state university budget by 40% and pretend that that's not going to cripple it, right? But we're not going to, you know, but it was built around denial. It was just, like, we're going to massively underfund everything and then, but act like it's going to be business as usual. But here, he's just, like, this is, like, a sort of escalation of austerity where he's just, like, we're not the kind of state that needs a university.
It's mask off.
Right. And a lot of it, okay. So there's, when he talks about what he's doing to, the university, what his excuse is, or what the right uses as an excuse, is generally like, oh, well, they have a bunch of different satellite programs and they have all these like extra, you know, fancy things that they're doing and they don't really need to be doing all that. But when you really look at that, the thing is that those things that they're doing, like their satellite programs and the things that are actually like really weird and expensive, are functions of the University of Fairbanks, which is actually a leading source of climate change information worldwide. Mm. Like, this is literally one of the most important research sites to track climate change and to talk about the effects of climate change on the Arctic and places within the Arctic Circle. And like, you know,
so
you know,
wait, are you suggesting like on some hat, level that this is a bit of a bank shot? That there's a twofer. Listen, there's a twofer here.
I don't know if there's a tinfoil hat that will fit me anymore.
Right.
To be honest with you, knowing that this guy Dunleavy's like entire campaign, his reign, as it were, and everything that he's doing is. There's a woman that he hired and I can't think of her name right now. And she's worked for several different states. She's basically bounced around the United States. And this is a person who you guys would probably be really interested in looking into, but she's worked in a bunch of different states and her job basically is to be the Mitch McConnell of state legislatures. So she rolls up and works for the right in various different state legislatures and allows them to slash their budgets and destroy things that people love. And then she takes all the heat for it. And then she just up and bounces and goes on to the next state.
What's her name?
She's done this in several different states. I don't know. Maybe Matt, if you want to look it up, I don't want to use airtime to look it up right now, but the point
send
is
send us
that,
an email at Majority Reporters.
This is what her job is.
All right. Well,
and she's even come out and said this literally. She's actually said in interviews, well, listen, like, yeah, well, it makes it easier for the people I work for if I can just move on later.
Do us a favor. Find what you're talking about. Send it to us at Majority Reporters. And I appreciate the call. Fascinating thing.
All right.
Try to pay a little more attention to what's going
on.
Anyway,
listen, if I can just real quick do a hashtag, if anybody's listening right now, if this is something that you want to get involved in, the hashtag recall Dunleavy. The guy's name is Dunleavy, D-U-N-L-E-A-V-Y. Recall Dunleavy has been trending. You know, any kind of visibility or support from anybody is super welcome, because there's a lot of small communities of indigenous people that are underserved in places that these services really, really support. And there's a lot of people that depend on this. So if you're a person that likes to get involved in these sort of things, I really urge you to lend as much support as you're able to Alaska and the people there.
Appreciate the call. Thanks.
Love you guys. Right. Thank you.
Interesting stuff. All right, folks. That's it for us. Tom Skoka. Am I pronouncing your name right?
Skoka.
Longo. Skoka.
Rhymes with Lee Iacocca.
Tom Skoka. It sort of rhymes with Lee Iacocca.
It does.
I knew Lee Iacocca, and then I knew Tom Skoka. Yeah, that does.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Tom Skoka.
Trust me.
From Slate, the newly coronated. Is that what happens? Is there a coronation with the politics editor over there? What do you do? You have like some type of like,
you know,
ceremony?
It's American politics, so you're not going to crown anybody.
Right.
It's a pageant. You have like somebody dressed as Liberty leading the people, and then, you know.
It's like being the May Queen.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your time today. Folks can check out your work, obviously, at Slate. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. Choice was made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.